Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we go. That's better. And here we go. It is the first program of the month of October. Another month gone past with the Swede beaten. Thank you, one and all. Thank you, everybody, for making that possible. 9 consecutive months of Swede beating, and we're working on the 10th now. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live, and that, of course, is where you go if you want to be part of the madcap zany multimedia extravaganza in real time. That happens during the program, the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room. That's where you go. Just pick yourself out a screen name and a password. And you will be, if you jump in there right now, you will be greeted by Anatole, Don from Central PA, Hoghead, Jugapunch, Steve from Georgia, Stan, and others as they meander in. We don't stand on ceremony or ring a tardy bell or anything around here. But they're all there, and they're waiting for you if you've never tried it before. It's an experience unlike any other. Wait a minute, I think CBS owns that. They say that every year at the time of the Masters. There's some tinkling piano from the butler cabin or something like that. Anyway, they will happily meet you there, and you will be, of course, moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third stage guild navigator, has folded space this evening to become Man Cave because they got a little rain in Northern California this past weekend. It kept the man cave from being too furnace-like for Sparky to be able to operate therefrom. Yes, indeed, it is the first broadcast of the month of October. That means that Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge is on the table. You know, this time of month rolls around, and in order to get the month off and running in rare and proper form, Shirley steps up and puts $200 on the table. Well, an offer of $200 on the table. And if during the program that $200 is met by 200 other friendly dollars, then your dollars get doubled. That's right. Your 5 becomes 10, 10, 20, 20, 40, etc. And so consequently, that's all that has to happen. Just, whatever you want to kick in will be doubled. And once we get to $200, it'll become $400, and we'll be off and running for the month of October. And jump out, and, well, there's been a... seems like there's always a frenzy of bill paying here, because there's a frenzy of bills to pay in this little, tiny, itsy-bitsy broadcast operation. You know, it's not like we send out the emails every couple of months saying, only $78,000 more to go. No. We just try to raise $200 every evening. And that helps us. Well, that's the only reason we remain on the air. You, me, us, we, this magnificent little community that you have built and maintained for these many years, in excess of 12 of them. Yes. So that's where we find ourselves. And my God, it's the month of October. We'll be celebrating our anniversary this month. This is an anniversary month. Yes, it is. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I forgot about that part. I always do. That's what happens when you're not, when radio is not ego-driven. But I am. I am. It really, really is. It's our anniversary month on the 24th. Is the 24th even, I don't know. Let me look at the calendar here. Yeah, the 24th will be exactly 1, 2, 3 weeks from today. And that will be our official 11th anniversary as an internet-only standalone operation. Yes, on October the 24th. We've been at this now since February of 2004, and I started filling in for Dr. Bill back in May of 2003. But yeah, the official 11th anniversary of the online-only version of the Horn will take place on October 24th, 2016, between the hours of 6 p.m. and 9 p.m., and there will be, like, party hats and favors and noisemakers. Hey, look, here's a noisemaker. Yay! So that's a genuine Joe Biden big deal, right? Yeah. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy. Yes, loud and clear on TuneIn, Bob. I appreciate knowing that. Thank you very much indeed. So Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge is on the table, and hopefully that will be met in short order. Oh, there you go. Wishful thinking. Marty says, not only the Horn's anniversary, but hopefully another parade down Market Street in San Francisco. Must I state what will have happened for that parade to take place? No, the World Series. And I don't know. I'm not thinking you're getting a parade in San Francisco, Marty. I could be wrong. Of course, the folks in Chicago who are counting on a parade there, no. I mean, good record, good baseball, just equity doesn't bet that way. Sorry. So here we are, Moran Monday, and here in just a very few minutes, I'm going to be tickled pink to welcome to the program our dear friend Dr. John, longtime listener and supporter and contributor to the program, but also a real live, honest to goodness, no kidding journalist. And we're going to talk about a story that I've sort of held for the depth of discussion that it needed. And Dr. John has been deep into the story. And we'll talk about that at some length, namely what we know now about another aspect of the opioid drug epidemic in this country. Epidemic? Pandemic? I don't know. And how we got there, and you know how things are quite often not as they seem. So that being the case, we're going to hold off on the official Moran Monday part of the problem. The official, and you know, they're always a problem, but we give them their own day here. We'll deal with Moran Monday probably in the second hour. Okay? Oh, if only. Don, with a note, says, subject line, bills. You could always not pay the bills and then have Rudy Giuliani, Chris Christie, and the others declare you to be a genius. Unfortunately, we don't have that. We don't have the kind of walking around money it takes to pull that off. But I agree that it's certainly it's a philosophical possibility, if nothing else. But since Don raises the issue, and since I know that as a professional broadcaster, it is my job to talk about nothing but Donald Trump, let's get this out of the way real quick, or at least one aspect of it. You know, somebody, Ivanka, or Ivana, Marla Maples, no, of course not, disgruntled ex-wife, somebody sent some of Donald J. Trump, billionaire who owns a mansion and a yacht and a jet, they sent his tax returns to the New York Times. Dear New York Times, please treat these dear little tax returns with all the care that they deserve. I am unable to see to their well-being anymore. Just put them in a basket and left it on the front door of the old gray lady. This, of course, then engendered a whole lot of Sturm und Drang. And it has sucked all the oxygen out of the room. You know, little dead babies being carried out of the rubble in Syria. Fuck you, kid! We've got to talk about Donald Trump! Right? You know, the various and sundry parts of the earth being poisoned beyond the ability of human beings to live on them anymore. People being murdered in anti-coal protests in India. Screw you! Donald Trump is the only thing that matters! Right? And lots of other stuff along those lines. But I want to get this sort of out of the way, if we could, please. Donald Trump lost $1 billion one year. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you can lose $1 billion running a casino is kind of laughable. Makes you wonder what kind of games they were running there. Which bird will fly off a wire, or guess the number that I'm thinking? But Donald Trump lost $1 billion. Well, not quite $1 billion. Almost $1 billion. $0.916 billion in one year. Yeah. And as a result, he probably didn't have to pay taxes for a lot of years after that. And, of course, the outrage machine has been cranked up to a level that humans, dogs, and you know, giant squids 3 miles under the ocean can hear it. Because it's outrageous. It is outrageous. It's offensive. You know, for years now, I've been talking about, especially in the context of describing what happens on Friday on the front porch, the extraordinary, ordinary roundtable of people who have tremendous expert authority, tremendous expertise in carrying America's wealth class on their backs. How many backs do you suppose it takes to carry a loser who screws up and loses $0.916 billion in a single year? Man, that is a lot of Walmart workers. That's a lot of 10W30 covered guys down in the pits at the Jiffy Lube. It really, really is. And, you know, the movers and shakers are the Trumpanzee surrogates are saying, well, you know, of course, I mean, he has an obligation to take all those deductions. If he doesn't, he could be sued. And on the deep side of things, this is an outrage. This is shocking, I tell you, shocking. See, you know that every so often, Chris Matthews, and he'll talk about those brave, bold days when 1986 Tax Reform Act is exactly what he of Donald J. Trump to lose $0.916 billion in a year and never have to pay taxes again. A Democrat and a Republican rolling up their sleeves and getting something done for America. See, before 1986, there were things like businessmen specials at the at your local ballpark, be it major or minor league, where working folks could knock off at, say, you know, 1 o'clock and go to the ball game and take some clients out and drink beer and eat cheap hot dogs and write all that crap off on their taxes. And mom and pop could go and buy a car and write the interest off on their taxes. All of that got taken away from everybody but the Donald Trumps of the world. And it ain't just Donald Trump, it's a lot of Donald Trumps. And it's still there for them because the real estate tycoons are very different from you and me. They get that kind of stuff. you do not. So hopefully we can just put that to bed now and understand where the responsibility lies. It ain't all on Trump. He's just the jackassed society representative who is the smiling, mooching face of the problem at the moment. But there's lots more, and it happens all over the country every day. And now, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. John, do we have you?
Hello, can you hear me? Yes.
I got you fine, Dr. John. Good to hear from you. It's been a while.
It has been a while, and it's a pleasure to get a chance to call in, especially to talk about issues like this. Although you're on a big one already tonight.
Well, I just wanted to get it out of the way, John, because I've been sitting here watching it for a few days, and it just, well, you know me, I've got to turn the thing, you know, 36 degrees in space, and the tilt and the yaw and the pitch and it looks like something entirely different when you do that. But I really did. I wanted to hold back and give some time to this opioid story. And I couldn't think of anybody better to talk with about it, because you have been knee deep in trying to comprehend the entirety of the picture. Of course, let's start just by letting people know, if you're comfortable, what you do in the daylight world.
Sure. In the context of this story, my name is on it and it's out there. I'm John Roby. I'm a reporter for the USA Today Network's Central New York newspapers, based in Binghamton, New York. I'm on the watchdog team up here. It's a small but active team, and the issue at hand here is a really terrific piece of reporting that I really only had a sort of a small role in, that landed nationwide back in September. This is the Politics of Pain series. That's a joint production by the Associated Press and the Center for Public Integrity, two, as you know, or as you may not know, actually, nonprofit news gathering organizations. CPI is somewhat new to the investigative reporting scene, but they've already collected a Pulitzer. And the Associated Press, of course, is, I think folks are familiar with. This is the nonprofit collaborative of news organizations that, well, if you open your newspaper, you're going to see AP reports. I think, and we know, you know, what
right,
the AP
yeah.
is. Yeah. This story is interesting, and it made a bit of a splash back in September. So what happened for this article is the AP and the CPI, they've got some data journalists that have done yeoman's work over the past 10 years, or excuse me, the past year, collecting state-by-state the political contributions to state and federal level politicians by companies and nonprofits that have a vested interest in expanding access to prescription opioids. This is the genesis of this story. So this is a really, really labor-intensive process. So over the past year, these folks have been going state by state through campaign finance disclosures for essentially every elected politician above the local level, and looking for totals that have come from folks that you might expect, the drug makers, the Purdue Pharmas, the Pfizers, these organizations, the big drug makers, but also this little cluster of nonprofit groups, some of which people have heard of, and some of which people probably haven't heard of, but they're all members of this organization called the Pain Care Forum, and their whole purpose is to essentially fight regulation of prescription opioids, and we'll get into this a bit more. But back to the politics of pain, what happened is the AP and CPI reporters came up with these two nationwide stories that landed back in September, and about a month before that happened, they reached out to reporters across the country at big papers, small papers, nonprofits, for-profits, and said, we've got this data set. We got some initial findings and conclusions. We're going to make it available to you guys to do with what you will. Localize away. Go through our data sets, see who in your state or your community have been getting a lot of money, and you're free to write to write about it, to use our data. You just can't publish before we do. And so the weekend is September 18th up here in my state, up here in New York, and several other states around the country and more since then, that exact thing has happened. So we had the drop of the two major investigative pieces and the drop of a whole bunch of sort of smaller, more focused investigations about who these folks are and how they're actually influencing state houses.
And part of the reason, and I'm speculating here, John, part of the reason that that the two organizations acted as they did, and I have a deep and abiding respect for the CPI. I love the idea of a nonprofit model of journalism, as I can imagine you, you're well aware.
Yeah, there's some good ones.
The reason they shared this data out and sort of open source journalismed it, there's a word, journalismed, is because there's nowhere in this country, it seems, that isn't being, and when I say touched by the opioid epidemic, I don't mean like a little, you know, pardon me, Mr. Tap on the shoulder. It's more like a kidney punch. There's nowhere in this country that hasn't its own more than fair share of agony and heartache arising out of this, and so consequently, there was probably everywhere that the data was made available, John, there was probably a compelling story of agony and grief.
No doubt, and there are certainly places where it's hit harder. The impact in West Virginia, for instance, I think on by some metrics is certainly greater than the impact in New York State. Although, like you said, there are problems everywhere. But in a big picture terms, look, in the past decade, 165,000 people have died directly of opioid related addiction. The toll is more exponentially if you count folks who have just struggling with addiction. If you think about lost productivity, about the cost of policing in jails, about the stress on public health systems, it's a massive and monumental problem.
It's also exposed our complete inability to cope with it. You mentioned healthcare systems, but our complete inability to cope with the conceptual side of this sort of addiction, isn't it?
What do you mean by the conceptual side? I'm interested.
We have traditional models for addiction treatment and recovery, and they're not they're either not funded or not existent enough to be able to cope with this. And even what is available isn't nearly available enough. We're talking about a system that is completely overwhelmed almost everywhere this problem arises, are we not?
Well, we are, and as another wrinkle, what the experts seem to be concluding is that opioid addiction doesn't look like alcohol addiction, and it doesn't look like cocaine or phenobarbitals or any of these other things that people have tended to abuse. So there's a much higher relapse rate with opioids. There's a much greater chance that you'll die without warning. And the infrastructure that exists isn't really equipped in most places, and I've done reporting on this in New York State, isn't really equipped to do immediate treatment, immediate detoxification, intensive treatment for a long period of time. There's insurance barriers. There's simply infrastructure barriers. There's the sense that you're an addict to opioids, you brought it on yourself. I mean, there's a lot of levels to what's standing in the way of getting meaningful access to treatment for people. Very true.
And yet, if we sort of back up into the investigation itself, here sits this seemingly benign sounding organization called the Pain Care Forum.
Yeah,
I mean that
sounds great.
They sound like they really, really care about people, don't they?
Well, they do really, really care about pain, and you can tell because they spend a lot of money. A little facetious, but this group, no one's ever heard of it. So there's a good reason, because this is a sort of loose umbrella organization of about 100 drug makers and nonprofits. The Pain Care Forum does not have a website. It doesn't have a headquarters. It doesn't have a spokesperson. For all intents and purposes, it doesn't exist. aside from providing a chance for all these groups to get together around the table, around the virtual table, to talk about and plan out legislative strategies, and they've been doing that. I should say as a caveat that all these groups, and I'll talk a bit more about a few of them, all these groups have interests that are far beyond simply opioid prescription drugs. So this is not that a single necessarily single focus for the American Cancer Society's Cancer Forum or even Pfizer or Purdue.
No,
you
know, but just as as an example, John, the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network.
Mm-hmm.
And is it not true that they, you know, they climbed the mountain to fight a measure in Tennessee that was designed to keep more babies from being born with narcotic addictions, and that came out of the Pain Care Forum?
Over and over again, what the AP found is that this Pain Care Forum members have inserted themselves into state level and federal level discussions of potential rulemaking. When there's talk of regulation, these people appear. And the fact that you have these disparate groups, so the American Cancer Society, it has a subset that you just mentioned, the Cancer Action Network, the American Academy of Pain Management, these groups like the U.S. Pain Council, all of these organizations, because they don't have a direct link to each other in an obvious sense, what happens is when they start lobbying state-level lawmakers, there's an echo chamber effect. So, you know, state house member in Tennessee can say, wow, you know, I'm hearing from these people with the Live Strong Foundation, and I'm hearing from these people with Purdue, and I'm hearing from these people with the Cancer Action Network. And they all appear to be acting independently, but lobbying for, in many cases, one thing, which is cutting regulations or preventing regulations designed to curtail prescription opioids.
And you'll forgive me if I say that sounds an awful lot like a model that's been rather successful in other areas, and has as an underpinning this idea that somehow regulating something is contrary to good business. ALEC comes to mind, frankly.
Yes, and there are some similar tactics that were uncovered in this. So, for instance, the stories uncovered something on the order of 100 bills in state houses that were designed to increase access to this specific kind of opioid formulation that I'd like to sort of save for a second here. But anyway, you got 100 bills that are saying we need to make it easier for people to get access to this kind of drug, and in at least 21 of those, the language is identical. So there must have been a bill zero at some point, and then it got picked up by different state houses. But it's difficult to prove for sure, obviously. But the thinking is you've got all these groups that are allied with each other, that are talking, that are spending money, and they've got all these legislation in their interest, and it's all identical. So there is some collaboration going on at some level here for sure.
I mean, you can't point your finger and say, yeah, here's Bill Zero, but we live in a political world, John, where identical bills will be introduced in 20 different states that all say, for instance, that we're going to restore religious freedom, and lo and behold, the focus of it seems to be pizza parlors and bathrooms, and it defies common sense to think that, I mean, along the lines of the old adage that that a million monkeys or infinite monkeys with infinite typewriters, one of them will write Shakespeare. Well, under these sort of circumstances, they wrote the entire Shakespeare library, and it beggars credulity, does it not?
Yeah, it does, and you could say charitably that's why organizations like this exist, to push an industry's agenda, and they've been successful in some senses, but not in all. So, for instance, does West Virginia have does West Virginia have limits on initial prescriptions of opioids?
Oh gosh, yes.
This is something that's new. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and there are no there are also no call-ins of opioids. One has to show up physically at the doctor's office in order to get the prescription.
Now, this is happening starting to happen in states around the country. New York passed it just this year. So there's a fairly hard 7-day limit on initial opioid prescriptions in the vast majority of cases. West Virginia, I would imagine you guys might have had it even longer. So this is kind of a new frontier, and it's something that the pain care forum was very adamant against. And it's a case where they have not been successful in many cases. The sort of backlash is more apparent. But the American Cancer Society's Cancer Action Network, the American Academy of Pain Management have openly fought limits on initial opioid prescriptions in the past, not so much in recent years because I think the scope of the problem is becoming a bit more than folks can really talk about. But those initial limits are a battle that the Pain Care Forum has largely lost or is losing in states. What they're winning on is kind of interesting, and this may get to the question folks are asking, that is this just something that these people woke up one morning and decided, you know, let's make sure that there's more drugs.
No.
So if it's okay with you, I'd like to kind of go into that.
Yeah, please do, because I mean I trust that the short answer is no.
Yeah, no.
But there is a history that runs behind that.
Very much. So the issue here is what are called abuse deterrent formulations. So for shorthand, ADF, and I'll use it because it's easier. What this is sort of reformulating an existing prescription opioid to make it, in theory, harder to use and abuse. So this is the OxyContin that is crush resistant, to try to prevent people from crushing and snorting it to get a quicker high.
Right, as I've referred to crushing it up for the refreshing burst of flavor.
Yeah, exactly. And these are this whole crush resistant or abuse deterrent is something that a lot of the drug makers and the pain care forum have been very active in trying to promote in state houses, starting 5 or 6 years ago when these first started to come on the market. And they've been very successful. So again, the New York example I'm most familiar with, for 3 years, our legislators attempted to pass bills that would, to some degree, require an ADF formulation to be offered to people when a prescription is written. So in other words, you go to the doctor, you're going to get a prescription, it's legit. They have to offer the chance for you to fill it with an ADF version of OxyContin versus a regular version of OxyContin. The effort failed a couple of years, and this past year it passed, and it's on the governor's desk right now. So it's been a yearly process of trying to encourage the use and prescription of these specific formulations. What's interesting about this is sort of two things. So first of all, critics describe this as a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. So as you can imagine, if you are going to get high off an opioid pill, what's the first thing you're going to do that? I would ask you. I mean, you're going to swallow it. I mean, it's a pill.
Yeah,
it's designed to be swallowed.
Right. Yeah, I mean, although you might even argue that ain't necessarily the case in a place like West Virginia. But I'm not making I'm not making fun of the hillbillies at this point.
No. No, I hear you, but you've got this, the way that abuse happens, and there's some amount of research behind this, is that the abuse comes because people are taking more and more and more pills, or they're taking it for longer than they should be, or they're taking other prescriptions.
Well, and in point of fact, I mean, there's a long history here, John. A lot of people, quite frankly, may have first come to awareness of the modern addictive quality of opioids in the Rush Limbaugh story. I mean, that was pretty stirring to find out that he was sending his maid out with $30,000 in a cigar box, and she was coming back with $30,000 worth of opioids that she'd bought on the street to maintain his addiction. And the point was he was taking such vast amounts of it because it had stopped being effective for him in the prescribed dose.
Exactly, and that's in microcosm or macrocosm, I guess. That's the problem here. And in fact, the CDC, if you look at their guidance for opioid prescriptions, they've been steadily walking back and saying, you know, longer is worse, less is better. Rethink how you're thinking about pain and what you're prescribing, because the evidence is getting better and better that for typical pain, opioids just aren't that good. They don't work that well, and they don't last. And you get this situation where, like Mr. Limbaugh, as he's admitted, you go more and more and more. And this is very, very
and it
common.
Was the same problem was apparently at one point, maybe still is, huge in the NFL.
Yes.
where you had accounts of players who were taking more and more and more because the dosage wasn't getting the job done. But
if you're prescribed it for pain and they say the doctor tells you to take it, what happens when it's not working? You take more. I mean, it's very understandable. It's very hard to fault people for doing exactly what a doctor told them to do. Just having to get more.
And if we can just sort of expand on this, the reason I wanted to devote as much time to this as I really, because I didn't feel like just, you know, me ranting away about it for 30 minutes was gonna do the job with this, is A, it is so pervasive in our culture. B, it is, there's so much agony involved with it. And C, there's the fact, and maybe this should be A, there's the fact that there are people out there who have been sacrificed on the altars of industry and heavy labor. And a variety of other work environments, mainly, who have a legitimate need, and I mean, I bring some personal experience to this,
mm-hmm.
Because I've got messed up insides,
mm-hmm.
and so I've been in literally doubled over pain in an ER, begging for some relief. And walked out of there being told, well, you know, what you need to do is not eat anything for 3 weeks and drink only water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you tell this to a guy who's borderline diabetic, and, you know, it's not a recipe for success, John. And so you've got a lot of, and, you know, people, especially in a place like West Virginia that's relied on industries like mining and timber and the oil and gas industry, all of which are hard and you know, construction. All of which are hard on the human body, and you've got and so there are people who need them for short or long term, what have you, and those people are on the losing end of this debate because it gets harder and harder and harder for them to be prescribed them.
Well, it is, and that's really a side of this that is a lot more opaque and not a big part of the discussion, but. You've got people who are recovering from cancer pain. You've got people who are under end-of-life care. You've got people with very specific major surgery issues, or like you're talking about, it maybe seems a little strange, but major gastrointestinal problems that these things can certainly help, or they could, in a very targeted way, in a very controlled and regulated way. And that's the argument for... that comes out of some of these nonprofits who are allied against the pain care forum. Their point isn't we can't have opioids. The point is we need to strictly and stringently regulate them to make sure that the people who need them are getting them and the people who don't need them are not getting them. That's the contours of the debate. But the side you're talking about is, I agree, actually very underreported.
And just to add a little bit of a personal wrinkle into it, there's the other side of the coin, and this goes back to 2011, when my wife, Agnes, was making a simple left turn onto the little road where we live and was rear-ended in our then rusty red pickup truck by the chauffeur for the local codeine carpool.
Mm.
And just because I've got cute little names for things like that doesn't mean that it isn't serious. This guy had a reputation for, and it happened all over this state. People would get a carload of people together with a carload of prescriptions, and they would drive to Florida. And the guy who was putting up the gas and the time behind the wheel would take in payment a percentage of everybody's prescription when they went down to one of the pain clinics that popped up like mushrooms after a spring rain in Florida. And so he was the guy who rear-ended and totaled my truck, and just unleashed hell for, you know, for my wife in terms of her ability to get through any given day.
And so,
you know, there is, and not nearly to the extent of people who have lost loved ones or anything, but there's a personal aspect to this that I find impossible to simply look away from, because that dynamic tension between the people who legitimately need them and the people who, and the thing is, you mentioned something early on, John, about how some people tend to insert a little bit of bias, a certain amount of bias into this, saying, well, you know, they never should have got on the damn things in the first place.
Yep.
The number of people I would guess, and you can confirm or refute, who become addicted to pain medications simply because they decided one day that, you know, they were bored with smoking dope and drinking beer. So, you know, I'm going to take a pill. That's a pretty low number, isn't it?
It's a low number, and the numbers are, as you might imagine, hard to come by. But addiction tends to start with a legal prescription that is for so long that by the time the person is out of it, having gone through the dosage that was prescribed to them, they're addicted and they're looking and they're pill shopping or they're heroin shopping. By and large, that's how it happens. It's not kids at a pill party, you know, which may be an urban legend, taking the wrong thing and then going out craving. It's not people who are sort of thrill seeking. It starts with a legal prescription. I had a physician who's part of a group that is one of these anti-PCF groups. He told me that what he sees more than anything else is Vicodin. That's the drug. It tends to be prescribed for longer and for lesser pain for people who doctors don't tend to follow up on, and that's the gateway that he sees.
That fits with everything that I have understood about the problem. Now, so we have something complex going on here. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I was just going to say that kind of leads back into the issue with these abuse deterrent formulations. Is that, you know, if you accept what the research tends to be showing, that addiction begins with legal prescriptions that get out of hand, then you'll see, I think, that crush-resistant pills aren't the solution to the problem of getting folks addicted to opioids. They may be a viable solution for this subset of population who is addicted and shopping for drugs and able to find pills that are crush resistant and likes to take them in a powder form. Then they're out of luck. That it stops that group of people, but that's a very, very attenuated group of people. The suggestion is, if you want to make meaningful change to the addiction problem, the crush resistant pills, helpful maybe around the margins, is not a solution. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the other side of the abuse deterrent formulations is the profit side, and this is where the some of the motivations, I think, of some of the groups that are advocating for expanded access may become a little bit more clear. So, what you may know is that When a drug is patented, there's typically a 20-year protection for that particular formulation of a drug. So back in 1996, when Purdue Pharma released OxyContin, OxyContin is a long-release, high oxycodone formulation. So that it's got a whole bunch of this opioid, semi-synthetic opioid called oxycodone, which is chemically similar to hydrocodone and codeine and all these others. OxyContin is simply a sort of long-release version of that that's very high in oxycodone. When it was released in 96, Purdue Pharma got a 20-year patent on it, as is typical. That means that a generic drug maker could not essentially copy or make a very similar drug that's to oxycodone, OxyContin, for 20 years. When an abuse deterrent formulation is released, when a crush resistant version of OxyContin is released, that activates another patent on that formulation. So, whereas Purdue Pharma was looking at the end of its patent for OxyContin, when it came up with this crush-resistant version back in, I believe, 2010, it got another 2 decades of protection, at least for that formulation. So the motivation here to expand access to, or even in some cases require access to these abuse deterrent versions, has the effect of steering more business towards a drug maker's specific formulation that is under a long time patent protection. Does that make sense there? It's kind of a
yes.
Kind of
it absolutely does. I know a little bit about patent law and not a lot, but a tiny little bit. And so every time they modify the structure, it triggers a new patent. The same thing happened with the first, and I can't remember who made it, but the first of the proton pump inhibitors that provided so much relief from acid reflux and such. What was the name of that? Prilosec.
Right.
The patent was running out, so they put a coating on it, turned it purple, and got a new patent for Nexium, when it was the same drug, for all intents
and purposes. Is that why they called it the purple pill?
Yes.
I remember those ads. Okay.
Because there was a lot of argument at the time that really this was not anything that was deserving of a new patent, but they got it anyway.
Yeah, interesting. Just incidentally, Purdue, it's sort of hard to estimate, but a pretty good estimate is that they've made about $35 billion off OxyContin since 1996. It's pretty huge amount of money.
Good work if you can get it. And this is all happening at the time that there's a re-understanding or a re-evaluation of what pain means inside the American medical community.
And a corresponding push for doctors to treat pain more aggressively. Absolutely. The LA Times has done some fabulous reporting on this in the past couple of months. Starting in the mid-90s, there was a coordinated push to get doctors to think about pain in a different way, to understand it as even another vital sign. If doctors are thinking about pain as something that needs to be treated aggressively, Purdue was one of the first with OxyContin to suggest that we have this opioid that is a great treatment for non-cancer, moderate to severe pain. Previously, what doctors say is they would not have considered using an opioid for non-cancer, moderate to severe pain, simply because of the risk of addiction, and because of the fact that opioids tend to work really well at the beginning and not so great at the end. That all started to change around 96, around the time that OxyContin hit the market. And if you look at prescriptions for opioid drugs, particularly oxycodone-related opioid drugs, since then the increase is staggering nationwide.
And they poured. These medications poured into the several states, John, in ways that people who have legitimate needs probably never much thought about, and probably didn't much consider. But for instance, here in West Virginia, our former attorney general, who was a zealous advocate for ordinary folks, launched a series of lawsuits against pharmaceutical manufacturers, including some of the folks that you've mentioned,
yes,
because of the problems that they had created by flooding the market. I mean, I forget what the exact number was, but it was an astonishing number of if you took the number of West Virginians there are and divided them by the number and divided into it the number of pills, or divided the number of pills in the state by the number of West Virginians. You know me and math. You came up with this crazy number of opioids for every last man, woman, and child in this state. And, of yep. course, every last man, woman, and child weren't getting them. And the argument was is that, you know,
right.
here in the hills, we just call them pill rollers.
Mm-hmm.
That really happened here for a while.
Well, it did, and don't forget that pharmacies are businesses. They don't have warehouses full of oxycodone formulations if they don't think that they're going to sell them, and if that requires a prescription. So it's not that this stuff is flooding in. It's that it's being prescribed, and the flooding in is meeting a demand that is there. Now, is the demand legitimate or not? I know your attorney general, I believe, is trying to make the case that it wasn't, and that folks knew that. It's an interesting case. I had some movement on it in the very recent weeks. I know I have.
Well, the funny thing about our present attorney general, John, is that he was sent into West Virginia by ALEC, arguably specifically for the purpose of getting rid of the good attorney general that we had. Because before he came to West Virginia, Patrick Morrissey had been, care to guess? I bet you know. A lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry, as is his wife to this day.
Interesting.
When he filed, there are these little regulations, little niceties that we have in the law here, and most states do. For instance, if you want to be the Attorney General of West Virginia, you actually have to be licensed to practice law in the state of West Virginia.
Seems reasonable.
Well, the pharmaceutical industry was so desperate to get rid of Daryl McGraw that Patrick Morrissey filed to run for attorney general, and he wasn't even licensed to practice here.
Hmm.
And so what has happened since is that he's gotten into office, and he's made some bloviating noise about opioids and our addiction problem in this state. But for the most part, he has drug his heels on the litigation that was already well in motion. And because of various and sundry conflicts of interest, his staff, have had to bail out of it. And so consequently, the road toward any sort of monetary recovery from these companies for the harm that they've caused the state of West Virginia is long in coming, and that train is nowhere near the station.
That's interesting, and especially if you look at the numbers. So along with these national investigations, you can, and I believe at the CPI link that I sent to you, you can look up individual legislators and look at their contributions. Would you care to guess who the top person or two in West Virginia to receive Pain Care Forum member contributions has been over the past 10 years?
Joe Manchin?
Number two. Want to guess who one is?
Oh.
Your other senator.
Oh, Shelley Moore Capito.
Yep, going back to 2006. So she's taken in $120,000, which is the twice Manchin's total. I don't know if that surprises you or not, but
no, not in the least.
He's on the list.
I'm actually the only thing surprises me out of that, John, is that Joe isn't number one. I mean, when you consider that in conjunction with the EpiPen fiasco, I mean, you want to talk about all in the family. So Heather Manchin Bresch gets a BS in political science, signs on. Daddy gets her a job with Mylan Pharmaceuticals, and she doesn't. And she's said in the past didn't really know what they did. Eventually, she winds up with a $16 million raise as CEO, largely on the back of this EpiPen fiasco. Then it turns out that Mama was the head of the National Association of State School Boards, where she went and pounded the table that every school must have oodles of EpiPens. And Joe, meanwhile, was in the Congress of the United States supporting legislation to provide money for the school boards to buy all the EpiPens from his daughter.
Hmm.
Yeah, what conflict of interest? What conflict of interest? So when you say that Joe, you can understand when you say Joe Manchin was number two. Well, there's many ways in which I can agree Joe Manchin is definitely number two. But in this instance, I'm surprised he's not number one.
Well, no comment on that, but I will say that when you start looking at the connections between some of these elected folks in state houses and the companies, the channel is wide and deep in many cases. If I could just sort of mention this too, what is really striking to me about this particular series is that the focus, although you know there was some attention paid to national level politicians and House and Senate, the focus is on the state houses, and that's really, really important. I think that a lot of times we ignore the things that are happening in our state capitals, and a lot of policy that is directly impacting on people, as you well know, that's where it happens. You know, the big races suck the oxygen out of the room, but if you want to know what's going to affect you next year, you got to look at your capital, and you got to look at your city hall and your county office building.
Right, and look at what people are worrying about in their annual meetings of these various and sundry industry groups and affinity groups. Now,
absolutely,
there's another aspect to all of this that never gets mentioned, and I couldn't see any mention of it in the reporting. And frankly, it may well have been beyond the scope. I mean, okay, there was mention of heroin, and you've mentioned mm-hmm. heroin, John.
Yeah.
We did not have, prior to the dawning of the 21st century, I mean, we had heroin. Heroin has, since its inception, always been around, to one degree or another. The stories are legion of what addiction has done in various and sundry communities or segments of society, the arts, music, etc. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when you heard about it the last time we got ourselves in an Asian war.
Yep.
We got ourselves a brand new shiny Asian war in 2001 in Afghanistan. And at the time, the Taliban had been, hard to say anything nice about the Taliban, John.
I've got nothing.
But, I got one thing. They had done such a magnificent job at opium poppy eradication that the federal government, the Bush administration, gave them, the W administration, Bush administration, had given them massive amounts of money to persist in their opium poppy eradication. And then came September 11th. And what they had done is they had taken, by virtue of some really brutal techniques, they had taken power away from the warlords, who largely controlled most of Afghanistan. And with the arrival of our shiny new Asian war in Afghanistan, the warlords came back to power, and of course, opium poppy production went through the roof again. And lo and behold, there was a flood of cheap heroin onto the American and, in fact, the world market.
Yep.
And when people cannot get relief of pain, or when people who started out with legitimate pain, I hate the word legitimate in front of anything.
We know what we mean here.
Yeah. I remember once hearing a very talented trial lawyer say, pain is a picture window into hell.
Wow.
And it is. But people who started out with a condition for which they were prescribed these medications, and who then went on into addiction, and then had their access to the medications dry up, well, hello, heroin. And suddenly you see it proliferating across the country, and it's not a fix, no pun intended, for the situation.
No, it's not, and it's hard to sort out. Well, we do a pretty terrible job of actually tracking and counting who dies of overdose, period. But it's hard to sort out the death with a proximate cause is from pills or from heroin. But the sort of conventional wisdom is that the pills dry up and people go to the street, and heroin is orders of magnitude cheaper than a legit oxycodone pill.
Yeah.
And along with that, you have questions of what's actually in it. So the fentanyl that's being mixed in is utterly deadly, and there's really no way to know that it's there or not, and so you have an overdose. So the chronology, what you're talking about, the sort of increase in availability and the drop in price for heroin on the street, it does track very well with the latest incursion into Asia. But, you know, this is the third wave of that. Like you said, back in the 70s, the same thing happened. We saw an influx of cheap heroin, and we're really still dealing with the social consequences of that. People with long-term methadone treatment and et cetera. And back in the 19th century, you know about the opium
wars.
Wars and the triangular trade between silver and tea and opium. And we seem to have a problem in the West when we adventure into Asia and opium comes back for the ride.
Because, well, it's hard not to look at this and say that this is actually a classic market model. You get when one item becomes scarce inside a market dynamic, another product will arise to meet the need. And because there's no regulation on something like heroin, then the next thing you know, you get bathtub fentanyl, and now this latest manifestation, carfentanil, which is literally elephant heroin.
Right.
Killing people and, 200 in a day, 40 in a day in a little tiny town like Charleston. And it all has its roots in our inability to cope with essential human suffering. Or at least that's what it comes back to for me.
I think that's true, but my concern is that because we're having trouble sort of coming to policy to head off or curb addiction as it, you know, before it happens, what we're going to be left with, if whether we're talking about expanded access to treatment, that's great. Talking about maybe supervised injection as a harm reduction system that there's some experimentation going on with, that's wonderful. But until we can manage to curb the new addicts that are being created, by legal prescriptions, we're looking at a lost generation of people here. Eventually, we'll get on top of it, and we won't be creating new addicts. But until that happens, or between now and when that happens, we've got this enormous group of people that are going to be struggling with this for life.
So don't mind, John, let's talk a little bit about that aspect of it. You mentioned that it begins by swallowing the pill. Are there any metrics out there on how addiction happens with these substances, because I know there's been research on alcohol, and I think some on nicotine. I remember C. Everett Koop declaring that nicotine was 10 times more addictive than heroin. I believe it as an addict. But for instance, somebody has surgery and they come home from their surgery. Let's posit that, you know, it's not life-threatening surgery. It's just, you know, it's just surgery enough that it's really, really painful to get over for a few days. So they've got
an 18-year-old playing football with a knee injury. Okay.
Okay.
That's the classic. Sure.
I was thinking gallbladder, but that same thing.
Okay. Well,
but you come home with 30 hydrocodone pills, 30 Vicodins.
Right.
And the instructions say to take one every 6 hours for pain. And in the immediate aftermath of surgery, it's not a PRN situation. It's not an as needed situation. It's a please get out in front of the pain and stay that way until, you know, you're recovered.
Correct.
Are there any numbers? Is there any kind of data on how long it takes to become addicted to something like that, or when the addiction issue arises?
I'm gonna punt this a little bit because this is something that people are looking at. It varies from person to person, is my understanding of the current state of knowledge. I will say this, that when restrictions on initial prescriptions are being put into place, they are largely moving from 30 days to 7 days. So if that gives you a sense of what the current thinking is on avoiding typical prescription addiction, don't do it for a month, do it for a week if you have to do it, is that's kind of the state of the thinking now, but there's variation by individual, by the type of pain, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's exactly what I saw is a prescription for what worked out to 5 days of a fairly sturdy opioid. And is there a relationship between the presence of the pain itself and the medication, the neuroreceptors that it lands on, whatever, versus taking it when the pain receptors are not being lit up? Does that contribute to addiction?
That's kind of the insidious thing about it, is that, as you said, you stay ahead of the pain, and probably there are people in your audience who can speak to this from direct experience. But the my understanding of the way the doctors talk about this now is that if you are wait to the point where the pain is there, it's not gonna get on top of it the way it would otherwise. It may take more, and you're not going to get the same relief, and that creates this compulsion to take more to get back to the normal feeling that you should have. So it's the snowball rolling downhill when you fall behind, when you miss a dose, or when you've got the pain, your prescription's out, and you're out there looking for something.
Because that's something that has been described specifically to me, is that if you have real and significant pain that this stuff responds to or acts upon, mm-hmm. that it actually, it doesn't make you feel high. It doesn't make you feel like you're unsafe to go and operate heavy machinery. Mm-hmm. It makes you feel normal.
It lets you cope, yeah. It lets you function, yeah.
Whereas the one person who had dealt with it said to me, listen, when you take it and you do get kind of whee, you know you shouldn't be taking it.
Yeah, but that can be a subtle clue in some people.
And that's the problem. In some people, there is right. no uniform standardized answer any more than right. there is with any other form of addiction. We mentioned early on, and this has been a magnificent conversation. I hope I'm not monopolizing too much of your time away from your work or your family.
No.
But there are a couple of aspects here that I think deserve a little bit more examination. And one of them is simply the question of access, and we've touched upon the inadequacy of modern understandings of addiction, but the access to any sort of addiction treatment. How serious is that problem? Because just looking at it from my little microcosm in West Virginia, John, it's crippling in its own right. There are waiting lists that have waiting lists in this state.
Right. I think you touched on a big part of it, which is that it varies by jurisdiction, by state to state. And the other thing too is that there's a lot of variation in what a particular person with an addiction needs. Some people, the research is clear. Some people respond very, very well to a minor behavioral modification, cognitive therapy, that sort of thing. Even these self-help groups, like these 12-step programs, which are not treatment, but are a model that works for some people in some cases. With other people, you could sit down and do behavioral therapy all day long, and it's not going to help. What they need is some of this medical intervention, some of these substances that block the effects of opioids or like methadone, create a bit of the sense that's there to reduce the craving. Some people respond well to that. State by state, there are states that have access to medical assisted treatment that is fairly good. California is one. And there are states where the access is not non-existent, but very, very difficult. Long-term detox nationwide. There's a shortage of beds for people who need that intensive level of 24-hour treatment for a period of time. Not even to mention how long will insurance companies pay for this when they will.
How much of an aspect is, because when you mention how much insurance will pay for if they will, that's not a healthcare problem, John. That's not a science problem. That's a, if you'll pardon me for injecting the dirty word into it, that's a capitalism problem. How much of a problem
yeah, well,
is it?
It is. No, it is. In fairness to the insurance companies, there is not a necessarily a single completely accepted answer to how long should someone who needs full-time round-the-clock detox be in it for. Is it 28 days? Is it 90 days? Is it 30 days? But yeah, there's a great deal of research that says the more intensive your program is, the more access to medication-assisted treatment you have, the better your outcome is of not relapsing. Bear in mind, the relapse rates for opioids are enormous. Some people say as much as 2/3. So there's a reluctance on the insurance company's parts to fully fund this kind of access because there's not enough infrastructure, because the science isn't as clear as they would like it to be, and because the fact is they're probably going to be paying for it again if they agree to it once. I mean, there is a more or less legitimate objection to this on their part, I would say.
And when
I know you may not like that, but there is
no I understand it because they have to exist. They're not organic,
right?
And so they don't necessarily respond to for all the declarations that corporations are human beings or people. They don't respond like people respond to stress and stimuli,
right?
They're like a computer in that sense. They have to be sort of, you know, programmed, and
right.
And without the flexibility, you're gonna have problems. Another aspect of this, you know, we see the stories of people being revived after an injection of Narcan, and I forget the actual generic name for it.
Naloxone.
And it's of its sort. It's kind of a wonder drug, but in the same sense that after I've mentioned this on the program before. After you've had some sort of horrible shooting, we never follow up to find out what happened to the person who got shot and survived, or find out about what kind of ungodly medical bills they were subjected to. That sort of thing. After a person's been revived with Narcan, they don't stop being an addict, do they?
No, it's real difficult for them. And I kind of feel like a broken record here, but the outcomes are different depending on where you are in many cases. So there are states that mandate a trip to an emergency room, a transportation to an emergency room after an emergency worker, a cop, or a fireman, a firefighter, revives someone with naloxone. There are states where it's not mandated. So here in New York, we know, and I know because I've done stories on this and I've spoken to people on both sides of the revival. After you get up, after you're revived, you feel okay for a second, for a while. There are stories of people who are revived by naloxone and walk down the street. When the effect of it wears off, the opioid is still in the system and there's a crash. And there are actually people who have died within hours after a naloxone revival because it doesn't purge the drug from your system. And when it comes back, it tends to come back all at once and it can drop people on the street. There are multiple revivals of naloxone. If you talk to police around here, they'll tell you we see the same people very, very often, sometimes more than once a week.
And now they're seeing people who the standard dosage of naloxone doesn't work, double the dosage doesn't work, treble the dosage before they finally get a revival.
With these super powerful synthetics, there are multiple revivals being required in some cases. But as the follow-up, it varies. There even by and large, when you go to an ER, once you're up and you're stabilized, you tend to be out the door, and it depends on, in some cases, the hospital, the amount of follow-up care and referrals you get.
And your
insurance issue.
Right, yeah. And your access to health care.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then maybe you have a recommendation that you go seek a certain level of treatment, and maybe it exists. Maybe there's a bed for you. Maybe there's not.
Well, you know, you get popped for DUI, you're not going to get your license back before you go to drunk school.
Right.
And, you know, you'll go to a meeting a week or whatever, but whatever the state statutory requirement is, mm-hmm. we don't even in your informed opinion, is some sort of statutory or administrative requirement like that, would that be beneficial?
It would be beneficial if there was the infrastructure there. I mean, if we had full possible capacity for every sort of level of intensity of treatment that your population could conceivably need, it would be a great reason. The DUI works because it's
because people want their driver's licenses.
Yeah, but you can do these meetings in a church basement with a slide projector, whereas you don't need state licensing and beds and around the clock care and degreed people to oversee the folks. It's a very different situation. Would it help? Probably. I mean, look at what interventions for DWIs have done. I mean, recidivism is down. Overall, DUI is down. Deaths are even down. It's not really comparable. The question you're asking, I hope you see why it's not really comparable.
Oh, I do. I absolutely do.
It'd probably be great.
Let me ask you this, John. We've talked about this in a strictly from a perspective strictly focusing on the United States. But is this a giant pharmaceutical complexes are transnationals? Is this a problem that exists, say, in the UK or France or the Scandinavian countries or Japan or Australia?
You know, I know you're the reach of the community here is global. I would be very, very interested to hear the answer to that. I honestly don't know. I don't know if we are out there by ourselves on this. It would be it'd be fascinating to know, particularly what other countries are doing on the intervention level. I know that, for instance, supervised injection, this is a person with an addiction can actually go to a controlled environment with nurses and do their heroin, and they're monitored and saved if they start to die. This is happening in Vancouver, I know, and there's even up in upstate New York in the city of Ithaca, there's discussion of trying to do this. And I believe the model exists in Europe as well. But I'd be very curious.
Well, I am too, because it feels... You know, in the rest of the world, for instance, governments can negotiate drug prices.
Right.
Naturally, we can't, because we've got this anti-regulatory disease that we seem to be suffering with. And I just, you know, I would hypothesize that it probably isn't. I think that, I mean, obviously you read stories. There's a heroin problems in Switzerland. I've seen those in the past. But it's not the same thing as a pharmaceutical addiction problem, which kind of brings us full circle. And that is, you know, beyond the question of, say, the crush-resistant pills, which, you know, you have said, and I tend to agree, is not a complete panacea for the problem. What's the thinking legislatively, and with that thinking in terms of legislation, what are the chances of getting it through? Given what you've described about this this shadow network, if we dare call it that, of organizations that will jump in to try to keep regulation from happening.
Well, I'd say it's decidedly mixed. And I tend to put a lot of stock in these outfits like Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. This is one of these groups that tends to ally or that tends to stand up against the pain care forum legislatively. And the suggestion there is that if we want to reduce the numbers of people with addictions that are being created, the first thing we got to do is curtail significantly the amount of prescriptions that happen. So it's regulating prescription supplies, and it's stronger guidance from the CDC on when to and not to prescribe opioids, what kinds of pain and procedures should trigger their prescription. If you accept that the addicts are being created through legal prescriptions, then the natural solution to create fewer addicts is to create fewer prescriptions. That line seems very straightforward to me. The concern here is that this is this is what groups with a vested interest in expanding prescriptions are lining up and are spending in the past decade $885 million to prevent. They've not been successful lately. So that's interesting. So New York State, West Virginia, a whole bunch of other states have actually started to curtail the amount of prescriptions that can be given. And if you accept the conditions here, then that's progress. And the more that happens, the better we're going to be, at least in terms of not creating additional addicts. But it's still an enormously powerful lobby. There's a lot of money being put around. There's a lot of money being put into at least questionable solutions. The fact that they're outspent the NRA in the past decade by a factor of eight should probably tell you something.
It does. And just by way of letting you know, note coming in from Ron up in Canada. He says there's a supervised injection site coming on stream in Ottawa. The one in Vancouver has been a success despite the efforts of the past conservative federal government to shut it down because they claim it encouraged drug addiction, which is, you know, which is something that you get out of the conservatives. I mean, there was a battle here just for needle, and it's not a battle that's over. Needle exchanges.
That's the objection for every harm reduction initiative is it encourages use.
And yet you never see an argument that from the same sort of folks. And in fact, they present the counter argument. If we say, well, you know, listen, if we keep certain people from having access to firearms, that argument's never made.
Right.
Because, well, ideology, I guess.
That's interesting about Ottawa. Thank you, Ron.
And have there been any estimates of what kind? Because this is America, and it all does come down to money. If we were to make access to treatment and detox and things like that on the level that I think we're talking about it needing, what kind of money are we talking about?
Excuse me.
And if you need to say a lot, that's okay.
A lot of zeros. You know, on a really local level, there was a county here where the question was, could we spend another $100,000 to encourage a new detox center to open up? And the more or less official word from the county was, it probably wouldn't do much. I don't know how much it would cost, and neither do you, and whatever we come up with, it wouldn't be enough. I can't imagine anyone knows. I mean, replacing all the lead-lined sewer pipes in the Northeast would cost $7 or $8 billion. So take that number and, you know, factor it however you like.
And that's
a massive amount of money.
Yeah, and even if you're talking about massive amounts of money, you got to do the right thing with it, because one of the as you noted, for instance, California has a pretty respectable program.
Yeah.
West Virginia, we got people lining up to get on lists to get into detox programs. So
you need RNs, and you need psychologists, and you need licensed workers, and CDCs, and on and on. You need human power.
And you need to recognize that the problems of rural America are not one-to-one analogs with the problems of what happens in a more populated area.
Right. Absolutely.
Because they're not. John, I really, really do appreciate the fact that you've taken time to go over this with me, because, like I said, I felt like it needed considerably more depth than I was capable of giving it. It is a complicated problem. It is, and it's not a problem necessarily with any clear villains, is it?
No, I would say certainly not. This is the story here is a lot. The people that have been acting within the bounds of the law as they should be. This is just, an unintended, although not unforeseen, outcome.
And it'll be, I guess, one last question. Is anybody talking time frames out there? Because you said earlier, this is a problem, if I may paraphrase, it's only going to get worse if we don't get serious about it. You said lose a generation. That's a long time, John.
It is. It may be a little imprecision there, but a comparison that's made is number of opioid-related deaths to number of deaths at the peak of the AIDS crisis. For several reasons, that's not a great comparison, and there's some sort of issues with that on a lot of levels. But if you look at the death curve, the opioid deaths over the past couple of years are not leveling off. The rate is not slowing down, and it has not peaked, apparently, the way that it did with the HIV/AIDS crisis back in the 90s.
Well, as we wrap up the conversation, it occurs to me to recall the words of and you know how telling that this poem was, you know, banned, that it was litigated against. But you know, there's Allen Ginsberg. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night. You know, he's not talking about some sort of metaphysical thing.
No.
Starving, hysterical, naked, looking for an angry fix. That's real. And that's addiction.
Well, it's real and it's addiction. And when the best minds of the generation are lost, it gets all the attention. But there's people here that are being lost every day that you probably wouldn't apply that to. But the loss is as real and as tragic for the folks involved.
It's almost
Prince or anyone. Yeah.
It's almost, well, exactly. We lose a prince and we, mm-hmm. you know, we talk about it for hours.
Yep.
You know, a girl who had straight A's coming out of high school and, mm-hmm. gets addicted in her freshman year at college and winds up ODing 3 years later. You know, she doesn't often get the same press. And it's in a way, John, and I have you to thank for this, when we've got the best minds of one's generation, and I'm glad you brought it up. That's kind of the great man theory of history poking its head up again, isn't it?
There you go. We're losing the single mother who works at Walmart, now kids don't have mama anymore, and that's a tragedy in its own way. It's the loss of a life and the snuffing out of a candle that won't come back.
And that is a ripple that in its own right will run through generations.
Certainly.
John, thank you so much for all of this. Tell people, your journalism is, I read your stories and I enjoy them. If people want to follow you and see what you're writing, how can they?
Oh, they certainly can. I'm on Twitter, the number, you just search my name, John Roby. I am at PSBJ Roby. So, Peter, Sam, Barbara, J-R-O-B-Y.
Okay, via Twitter.
And I on Twitter. And I will say I have been a listener of the program and an occasional contributor going back, I think, to 2007. So in the interest of full disclosure there.
Absolutely. And to further that, you very kindly indulge my moments of occasional hysterical frustration with the sensationalization of archaeology stories, and that's all. I think we could almost together edit a volume of bad archaeology writing, John.
Hey, let's get together on that sometime. It was a real pleasure, Bob. Thank you, and thanks to your listeners for indulging me.
Oh, thank you so much, and I really appreciate you taking the time because I know how busy you are. John, have a good evening.
Good night. Thank
Bye
you.
Now. And that is a dear friend of the program, John Roby. We'll use that word, legitimate journalist, yeah, because I'm not one. See, I do opinion stuff, but John is out there doing real journalism every day, and his community is ever, ever so much better for having him in it. Just look him up on Twitter, and I'm pretty sure you'll find him. His last name is spelled R-O-B-Y, and his writing is top notch. We're halfway through the program now, and it's still More and Monday, and we've got More and Monday to deal with. But before we go any further, a reminder, and I misspoke at the beginning of the program in regard to Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. I posted about it yesterday, and Paul jumped in. That took it to 185 on Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. And Kelly just jumped in, and Ron just jumped in. So that leaves $85 to go in Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Remember, 50 becomes 100, 5 becomes 10, that sort of thing. So Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge is there, and there's not that far to go to knock it down. Let's run over and talk to Tracy. Hey, Tracy. Well, Tracy was there. Now Tracy's not there. Let's see if Tracy's back. Are you there, Tracy?
Hello?
Yeah, there you are.
Okay. I don't know what happened. My phone is, I think I might need a new Bluetooth because I've been having issues with when I call you. So I actually would go out and buy a new Bluetooth just to ensure that I could talk to you when I'm driving.
Okay.
How dedicated I am.
You are.
Hi, Bob. How the heck are you?
Pretty good. I thought that was a great conversation. I really appreciate John sharing the wealth of his information, and folks can.
Yeah, that was an awesome conversation, and it just makes me think about, because I've been reading articles this whole thing about the opiate addiction, and it is terrible. It's just, you know, it has devastated communities. People have lost parents, you know, to crime and everything. But then I think about the crack epidemic and what it did to the black community.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, we didn't get that kind of press now, did we?
Especially given what we later found out about the, you know, the origins of it.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's that anger thing that happens with me, because I'm like, you know, because I hadn't written the paper, but that was going to be like, I was going to actually write a paper about that, about how the crack epidemic was just as bad, if not worse, because you just think about, you don't have drive-bys in suburbia and all of that because, you know, crack of a heroin. You there's crime, but I lived through the crack wars of the 80s. Okay? My grandmother and my aunt and my cousin all booked on crack. My house got, because my cousin and my aunt were living with us at the time, and they, you know, they used their, what they were supposed to be selling. My house got firebombed because of it. My mom's car got set on fire because of it. And we had nothing to do with it, Bob. I wasn't using, my mom wasn't using, nobody else in the house wasn't using.
Just happened to be in the way.
Right. They had to destroy something. They couldn't get to my cousin or my aunt. So we were the next in line. And so I think about the drive-bys that happened in my neighborhood. That, you know, people, you know, when our parents were growing up with the atomic bomb and stuff, it was duck and cover. We had to learn how to duck and cover and pray that the bullets didn't pierce the concrete of our house.
Damn. And of course, within the modern heroin wars, if you will, there are plenty of innocent victims.
Right.
And it touches every community that's part of the, you know, Dr. John mentioned the opium trade, you know, silver, opium. Well, it's in the United States, it's heroin and guns. You know, you bring the heroin down, you sell it, and you use it to buy guns in a gun-friendly state, and you take it back and you enforce your turf wars.
And I'm glad people are getting the help that they need.
Losing your audio, Tracy.
It affects white people more than it, you know, because it was all about, you know, suburbia and all. And I'm like, God damn it. That just shows again how black lives don't matter.
Hey, Tracy.
You gotta wonder.
Tracy.
You know,
Tracy, can you hear me? Tracy. Hey, Tracy.
I mean, of course, there are white people who have drug convictions, but not on the same level as black people. But then again, you know, you think about it, like when you fill out the financial aid form, you could be, if they let Charles Manson out of jail today, he could go apply for financial aid.
Because it wasn't a drug crime.
The selling conviction had nothing to do with drugs.
Tracy, I don't know if you can hear. I'm losing a whole bunch of your audio. You've become very, very far away. It's like I think your Bluetooth kicked out or something.
It has nothing to do with this drug-related. You don't help it. I'm hoping that Hillary, when she gets into office, she gets into office, she does something about these draconian drug laws, because it affects a disproportionate amount of people in communities of color.
Well, there was a hint about that the other day, Tracy. Chelsea was talking somewhere. I'm not trying to overtalk. Tracy, are you there?
No. Okay.
Okay.
Can you hear me now? My speakerphone is stupid.
Yeah, you got really, really distant for a while, and you couldn't even hear me. Can you hear
me
now?
Okay. Hello?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. But what you were saying about Hillary, and of course, you can't the only thing you could expect from Benito Cheeto is that he would behave like that one, that brother from another mother that he has over in the Philippines who just wants to go out and use the powers of government to start wasting people on the streets. And you know who those guns are going to be pointed at. But Hillary did, there was sort of a clue, I guess, a couple of weeks back. Someone was asking Chelsea at some event about, you know, cannabis. And she said, of course, it's ridiculous that cannabis is still a Schedule I narcotic or substance.
Right.
So, if Hillary Clinton is inclined to push for the removal of cannabis as Schedule I, even booting it down to Schedule II, that makes some difference. It's not legalization. And frankly, my guess is the state of this country being what it is, we're not gonna legalize on a federal level. It's going to be, unfortunately, state by state as a manifestation of states' rights. So, consequently, they'll keep putting people in prison, black, white, and whatever, in places like Alabama and Mississippi, Stan, while other states eventually become more enlightened.
But it still sucks is, even though, you know, it's legal here in California for medicinal purposes, which I am definitely eligible, you know, because of my condition, it would definitely help me load. But because, you know, it's the DEA runs the drug. See, this is the stupid. You know, why? Okay, if we have states, if we're all yelling and hollering about states' rights, why is it that a person in a state that it is legal, if for medical or recreational use, to smoke marijuana, use marijuana, or what have you, shouldn't that state be the one, their Department of Justice be the, or whatever? Why do we have to run, you know, use DEA standards as far as marijuana is concerned? Why can't the state use their own, you know, guidelines for testing? So if a person is using marijuana, they don't get, like me, I can't smoke it. Even though it would probably do me better than any, you know, of the the man-made pharmaceuticals that are out today. But if I get caught, if I get a random pee test, I'm done.
Right. And the question is, I think we're dealing with multiple questions, Tracy. One is drug policy generally in the United States and the idiocy of our ongoing prohibition vis-a-vis cannabis.
Right.
The other question, though, is a question of, and frankly, it's going to get more research and more study because it's already a part of the stream of consumer capitalism, the question of what happens with pharmaceutical opioids.
Right.
I mean, if you pee dirty with opioids, they'll take you off the road just as fast. Even if you've got a legitimate prescription for it, because, you know, you're not supposed to be operating heavy machinery or, you know, operating as a common carrier while, quote unquote, under the influence, right?
Right.
And so, because of the number of people who are dying within our opioid crisis, I get the sense that that will be at least bloviated about. And let's understand from jump that the only thing our government, at least on a federal level, is capable of is bloviating. We have the most dysfunctional Congress in the history of the United States. And there is
exactly. There
is no data whatsoever of which I am aware to suggest that they're ever going to be, that they're going to become non-dysfunctional anytime soon. So
we're probably not looking at a functioning Congress that's at least functioning. I didn't say great, but functioning probably not until 2020, if we're lucky.
Yeah.
So we basically have 4 more years of crazy.
Depending on how this plays out. You've got 4 years of how quickly can we get to the apocalypse under Trump with a with a compliant Republican Congress. And, you know, make no mistake, when Jill Stein said, oh, well, you know, the Congress will stymie his blah, 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 you know, I'll stop it. Because see, what'll happen is eventually even the old guard Republicans, the never Trumpers, will come around because they like their power. Look at Ted Cruz a couple of weeks ago.
Like Ted Cruz, for God's sake.
Suddenly the check cleared, and the next thing you know, he said he was voting for Trump because Hillary.
Right.
And you know, history in a time of strong men and demagogues tends to suggest that that's how they'll respond. They will become compliant.
And they will. Just because the Bushes are saying that they're going to vote for Hillary and all that, they're not in Congress. They have nothing to lose if they say they're voting for Hillary. Jeb Bush isn't running for office again. W's not running for office again.
Right, so, and I mean, I've got a clip, and we won't bother to play it, of the Morning Joe crew, you know, clutching their pearls, and there sits Nicole Wallace, who was part and parcel of the W, if you're not with us, you're against us administration, and they're shocked, I tell you, shocked, Tracy, at the atrocious behavior of this awful, awful man, when in fact, you know, she was a part of creating the world in which he could become a thing.
Yep.
And so was Joe Scarborough back in Congress, when he went into the House of Representatives under Newt Gingrich's Contract on America. I mean, for America, with America. Yes, I said Newt Gingrich.
Okay.
Newton Leroy Gingrich, amateur paleontologist.
But
they were part of it, and I have no sympathy for them now as they watch, as they watch their, you know, their party isn't devolving. Their party is merely showing its true face.
True. And this is what I keep telling people. It's not that this did not all of a sudden happen. Okay? Trump has given people permission to take off the sheets, okay, and be all out in public with this. There have been people have been racist since Jump Street, okay? They just took lessons on how to behave in public.
And then the racists...
You run into it all the time, especially being white. When you, like you said, you've told these stories of when you're at a store or somewhere and you get the nudge and the double wink, you know, about those people and all this. And you're like, wait, hold up, homie. Don't mistake that just because I'm white, I'm down with this bullshit. You know?
Yeah.
Right?
And you know, let's understand something else. You said that, you know, they've given a certain segment of America the right to take off the sheets. I'd say that if we're just going to mess around with the imagery for a minute, they've given a certain segment of America permission to put the sheets on and get out in public with them. That's step one. That's the racists. But the racists have in turn given lessons to the misogynists. And they've given lessons in turn to the xenophobes and the homophobes, and so consequently they've brought all of this stuff that the Republican Party used to just whisper about behind closed doors out into broad daylight, and suddenly we're going, shit, we've still got all that? Yes, we've still got all that. That never went away. The stuff that Trump
is
the stuff that Trump's doing now has its roots in 1948 and Strom Thurmond.
Exactly.
Everything that Trump's doing today has a line that runs straight as an arrow back to 1968 and George Wallace and Nixon's Southern strategy. And what, 1988, and George H.W. Bush and Willie Horton.
Exactly.
And, you know, the Morning Joe bunch were so appalled, Tracy, because over the weekend, the Mar-a-Lago Mussolini, in his stage act at one of his rallies, jiggled around and mocked Hillary Clinton for, you know, passing out in the heat. And they were like, and they just, you know, my God, this is shocking, shocking. Well, you know what? You know where he got that, Tracy? I know you know where he got that, because I know you remember 2012. He got that. He got that from Rush and Limbaugh. Okay, that's where he got that. Rush Limbaugh jiggling on camera and making fun. Rush Limbaugh looked like a Jabba the Hutt made of jelly, the way he was jiggling and making fun of Michael J. Fox's Parkinson's disease and every other sufferer of Parkinson's disease in the United States. So now the Republicans have a presidential candidate that does it in front of, I presume, thousands of people in Pennsylvania or wherever. And the good God fearing upstanding Bible believing Christ centered evangelical Republicans on Morning Joe, I can't believe he did that. Well, you dumb bastards, you're part of that world.
We said this before. For all those good Christian folks that would never, you know, we're not saying that all Republicans are like Joe Scarborough and Newt Gingrich.
Oh, of course. We've got to put the caveat
Trump, don't we? Right. But the thing is, for the ones that aren't like that, who when they heard the jokes of the misogynistic, the homophobic, the xenophobic, the, you know, racist jokes or comments, and they said, they either did that nervous laugh or they said nothing, thank you. Because, see, when you don't call people on stuff, it continues. Because if you had said, you know what, I don't allow talk like this in my house, or I don't condone this kind of behavior. So, and if more people had have done it late, you know, earlier, back in the day, or shit, just 5 years ago, maybe we would have a chance. But when you are constantly, or hell, if, you know, Congress or somebody in Congress wouldn't, you know, would say, wait a minute, how are you going to say this about our president, regardless of his color? He's our president. Nobody calls anybody on anything because they're a bunch of pussies.
Well, look, it goes back to that logical statement. Not all Republicans are racists, but all racists
are Republicans.
Or some further right variation on the theme.
Right, bullshit.
You know, you may have some clueless greens, but they're not. They're not going to the Clavern meeting on Saturday night.
No.
Those are you know, the people on our side are educable. I'm educable. I can be taught to think about the ramifications of my white privilege and my male privilege and my position inside the patriarchy.
Exactly.
But you know, the other side, no, they're unreachable. And look, let's say it. About half of them, you know, Hillary was right. About half of them are deplorable.
Exactly.
And there we go.
You know, and here it was great for me to, you know, Trey Crowder, you know, so I wound up going to the show. Jan didn't go, so I took Rick.
Yeah, okay, so that happened in the chat room. We want to hear about your date with Rick.
And he gave me permission to tell this, so you know he, can, you know, so I'm not, I'm gonna embarrass him. It's hilarious. So I texted Rick earlier that day on Saturday and asked him if he wanted to go, and he's like, oh, you know, let me just call you. So he called me, and we were talking. He's like, well, you know, I left my wallet with my ID at my office, and I actually have planned on going to get it, you know, on Sunday, but I don't really have time. I said, wait, Rick, so you are white, right? He's like, yeah. I'm like, so you're driving from one white part of town to another white part of town, and you're worried about not having your license? And then he thought about it. He's like, oh, yeah, huh? I said, is that the worst thing that you could worry about? You know, because even if you do get pulled over, chances are that you're not. You do know your license number by heart. People leave their licenses at home all the time.
Does he really know his license number by heart? Because I know mine.
He did. He said it. He's like, well, I do know my license number by heart. If per chance, you know, I get pulled over. And I'm like, you're not going to be, I said, but you're white. and what's so funny is that it wasn't like, it was just one of those things that just kind of cut, you know me, I have no filter. It's what I do, sort of. But for the most part, I don't. And I'm like, but you're white. And that's the first thing that came out of.
Are you there? Tracy? Tracy's having problems with technology this evening. Dang it. I wanted to hear about the show itself. Yep, we lost her. Gosh darn it. Well, Trey Crowder doesn't mail it in. It had to be funny. Okay, let's see if this works again. Yeah, because we can't lose our connection right before you're getting ready to tell us about the show itself.
I don't know what it is. So when was the last thing you heard?
If that's the worst thing that happens to you.
Yeah, if the worst thing that's ever happened to you that you know, are worried about driving without your license, then whatever.
So I just got a note from Billable Rick. I just got a note from Billable Rick. Subject line, Tracy. FYI, I didn't get a ticket on the way home Saturday night for driving while white. By the way, I couldn't be Tracy's date on Saturday because I also forgot to bring my gay card.
Oh,
Wouldn't that be your male lesbian card? I mean,
yeah, he needed to be the male lesbian card. As I must say, there was actually a very gorgeous lesbian couple sitting in front of us. I'm like, they were beautiful. And I'm like, wow. And they've been together for 8 months. They were adorable. Absolutely adorable. But, yeah, we had a great time. There was two other comedians three of them. And Drew was the last one, but I'm so mad at myself that I didn't have a pen and paper to write down some of the best parts. But the one thing that had me dying, he was talking about Pillbilly. You know, basically to what you guys were talking about earlier with the opiates. You know, how, you know, it's so addictive and stuff like that. But he was talking about how when people get drunk or stuff like that, they're chasing the retard dragon. And being happy is just a byproduct.
That's cold.
You wanna get, yeah. It you know, the whole show, and we got to talk to them after the show. We talked, you know, of course we plugged you, you know, because, you know, you're awesome. And, you know, they said, well, we're probably...
Oh, that's just way too sweet.
And they actually were talking about maybe giving you a call and calling into your show.
Hey, y'all.
And they wrote a book.
Yes,
they
did.
They have a book. And they sold me the display copy.
Well,
so I have the book, and they autographed it for me.
Who?
But I.
But I mean, was it gut busting funny?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it wasn't gut busting, but you know, there was a couple of tears. I wasn't holding my side that I was laughing so hard. But there was a couple, I was laughing so hard that I couldn't catch my breath a couple of times. But a lot of that's because I'm fat.
I guess they're on a West Coast swing, are they?
Well, actually, yeah, but I think they said they were going, they're going to New York, and then I guess they're coming back here. But I really, you know, I enjoyed myself, and I do not remember why I don't go to comedy clubs, because it really pisses me off. I have to pay to get in, and then you charge me a 2-drink minimum.
Oh. Was it a big venue? I mean, a good-sized crowd?
The Ice House isn't that big, but a lot of them, you know, it's about the size of most comedy clubs. I've learned that most comedy clubs aren't that big. It's not like, you know, stadium or anything like that. It probably set maybe 70 people, and it was, well, like, he said, here's the thing, all of his shows have sold out. The 10 o'clock show didn't sell out because of, you know, it's 10 o'clock. But the 8 o'clock show sold out. The show that I wanted to go to in Santa Monica, that sold out. So, yeah.
Well, how long a set was it?
Each guy did about 20 to 30 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was about an hour and a half for the whole show. And, of course, they didn't start on time, which, you know, it's no big deal to me they didn't start on time. But yeah, they're really good guys. You know, they hit all the pressure points about, you know, racism and bigotry and stuff like that. They didn't realize it, but I guess at the Ice House, they record their sets. So there's video, so I'm hoping that they put it up on their website.
Cool, cool. Well, you know, Billable Rick mentions that they will be on Sirius XM from October 17th to 21st, and they're headed to San Diego next, and then back to New York City.
Right, and they asked me if I had Sirius, because we were telling them about your show, and I said, because, you know, we, you know, the only liberal redneck hillbilly that's on the radio, you know, with a progressive radio show. And so, and I tell them I love to call into the show because I can cuss. You know, there's no FCC issues. And he's been like, oh, do you have Sirius Radio? And I'm like, no, I don't. He said, oh, because they're going to be on. I said, well, you know what? I'll see if they have a trial subscription. Usually most of those things do. I'll try it, you know, I'll get it, and then I'll cancel it.
Well, I know Boss Man Wayne. I know Boss Man Wayne does, so I'll let him know. Did they say what channel?
No, they did not. But I think you probably just have to check their website, because I asked them and they weren't sure. So this, you know, I told them, if the info going to be up on their website.
Well, and the thing I respect about him, and particularly Trey Crowder, is that, you know, A, you're obviously dealing with a very, very intelligent man. B, he's funny as hell. But C, he brooks no bullshit when it comes to, A, calling out the flaw. Okay, that would be one, calling out the flaws of, you know, hillbillies. But two, not putting up with any crap from people talking, you know, about hillbillies. And I mentioned that because this is a nice segue, Tracy, into Morian Monday. Michael, one of our Michaels, posted an article from JacobinMag.com titled Hillbilly Elitism. And it's more
hillbilly
or less...
Hillbilly Elitism.
Yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah, and I am the hillbilly elitist, for God's sakes. Instead, it's a review of J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, A Memoir of a Family and Culture in Crisis. And it's a pretty good deconstruction of J.D. Vance's work. And this book of his is getting way too much attention. And it's being treated way too seriously as some sort of textbook on the hillbilly condition. Or the redneck condition.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's a Jacobin, JacobinMag.com. The author writes...
Rob, you know I'm driving. Why do you do that to me?
Well, I'm sorry.
Can't write stuff down.
I'll tell you later. Everybody else ain't driving, Tracy.
Horn. Whatever. I thought this was all about me, so.
Yeah, well, okay.
narcissistic, are you?
Yeah, little. The author, Bob Hutton, says, the outpouring of right-wing support shouldn't be surprising. Vance, after all, is one of them, and Hillbilly Elegy staunchly defends the up-by-your-own-bootstraps fairy tale that capitalism is always used to win support from the underclasses. And it takes off and runs from there. So it's...
Oh, nice.
And the thing is, I'd love to hear those guys deconstructed. I'm kind of guessing they would. Because there's just a... Well, I mean, there's mention of the opiates problem. It's all in there. But it all comes down to personal responsibility.
Okay.
Meanwhile, taking Margie to work yesterday, I happened to be behind a rusted-out Toyota pickup truck with Virginia plates. I was like, yay! Getting some relief, because it wasn't West Virginia plates. And there was a bumper sticker on the back glass said, 100% redneck! And then on the other side of the back windshield glass was a sticker that showed the Confederate flag and said, keep it flying! And, you know, once again, my best answer to that, Tracy, is, well, I'm glad that jackass has that on his vehicle, because at least then I know that I'm dealing with a jackass. And I don't have to find it out the hard way. Right.
Exactly.
Well, Tracy, you have yourself a lovely, lovely evening. It's awfully good to talk to you. I'm glad you enjoyed the show. And, you know, sincerely, thank you for, mentioning my little old name. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, no, I mentioned it on many occasions. So, you know, gotta get you plugged up out there some way or another. So, like, if whatever I can do to keep, you know, to help the cause, I will do.
Well, I do appreciate it, and you have yourself a lovely evening as you head from as you head from the 105 to the 6 7/8. See you, Tracy. Bye now. The one and only lady cab driver from the far reaches of Los Angeles. That's Tracy. And that's Tracy. And this is Thomas. Hey, Thomas.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm finer than frog hair.
I'm doing pretty good myself, except for the whole, you know, PTSD thing. And I'm just surviving, as Donald Trump said earlier today.
Yeah, quick. And by the way, quick as you figure out how you can own a casino and lose $1 billion in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, holler, yep. Would you?
Oh, totally. As soon as I let you know how I get over dealing with a sexual assault that I've lived with every day since it's happened, totally will. I will get right on that. I just couldn't. I'm going to talk about that later tonight. I just couldn't imagine that. And the worst part was, Tom Hartman pointed this out earlier today, the worst part was the whole way the question was framed as, are you going to bring religion back into government, Mr. Trump? Yes.
It'll be beautiful religion. Huge.
Huge. It's going to, I'm going to put the $50 right in the wafer cracker thingy. Like I did the last time. That's where it's going to go. I can't this man. Oh, Lord. Seeing it on Right Wing Watch forced me to call Tom Hartman and declare myself a full-on, full-throated supporter of Hillary Clinton at this point. I thought I was tepid before, but after what he said, and because of what he said, and because of what I'm going through, and I know so many other people are going through, and how much I love the vets.
Stop telling people how to vote!
You know what? Doubting Tom at FYNation.com. I've already dealt with that once today. I'll be happy to again. I'm in fighting mode.
Oh, no. Hell hath no fury like a Doubting Thomas scorned.
And with a leaking valve, too. Mm.
Party.
Yeah. Right? You might get some on you.
Leaking valve. That's...
Yes, I have a cadaver valve, and I've had either an artificial valve or a cadaver valve since birth because my valve didn't form right. And my last checkup, I found out it's nothing major. It's not like cancer or anything, but there are certain steps. There are like three steps. Either you go on medication, you go and get a angioplasty where they like re-blow up. They give you like a pump and they pump up the valve and they fix you for a little while. Or they go in and replace the valve entirely. And because I've had the problem since birth, and thanks to the President of the United States, King of Kings, and wife who is Queen... Oh, I'm sorry. King of Kings, because, you know, what Alex Jones says. Because of the Affordable Care Act, I can go to the University of Michigan and find out that what I need to do, where do I have Donald Trump as president, I'm a dead man walking. As I know so many of my other friends who, you know, pre-existing conditions and stuff like that. So count me in as a single person voter.
Yeah, see, you're just selfish. You're just thinking about yourself. You're not thinking how we've got to take down the oligarchy, man.
Well, you know what? The oligarchy is not too happy about the Affordable Care Act. They keep pulling out faster than, you know, one of Sarah Palin's future husband.
I know what you're trying. Bristol's.
Yeah. We're going to have single payer by the time we're done, is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, that's fine by me, but we're not there yet. And we got to do what we got to do when we're here. And the here is now. But the other reason why I called you is to put an offer on the table.
Okay.
For the Horn Family Commune. We at FYI Nation are becoming a nonprofit. I know you're not a huge fan of doing that, but
nah, good luck to you. Good luck.
We're going a different way, and one of the things we are offering is a non-corporate, non-advertised, non-anything email address. Okay, your own bob@fyination.com. Your own Billy Bob at, you know, whatever you want, web-based, kind of like, actually, the program that we have that we're getting on my birthday, hopefully, and if not by October 31st, is almost exactly like Gmail that we're getting built for us. And we are, since it is a revolution that we are a part of, we are giving a one-time fee of $17.76 if you pay it.
Ah, clever.
And anyone who emails me and says, I heard about this on the Horn, I will give the Horn $10.
Oh, that's very generous. That's very kind.
So you sign up with us, we'll get $7.76, you get $10. And that is indefinite.
That's a fascinating idea. I mean, so it's an email addy.
Yes.
And there's not going to be any ads, and you're not going to run any algorithms to so that you can suggest that, you know, based on what people have in their emails, that you know, things they could go shopping for.
Nope, none of that. The most you will get, maybe, because we can mass mail you, is a schedule of show information, or if we have a major guest, or if somebody's coming on, or Bob, if you tell us you have a guest on and let us know, we'll let everybody know. And you will be able to help get the word out for FYI Nation and help the Horn. And it's a one-time fee that... we'll pay for the domain name. Our hosting is subsidized by our boss man, which is Boss Man Steven. So that's one thing we don't have to worry about, luckily. So we're able to do that. And because we're not trying to be Gmail, we can keep this kind of small and kind of intimate and kind of communal-like.
And people will have a real human being they can reach out to if something goes sideways?
That would be me. I just put up the SSL, which we're working on doing the fixes for. I don't know how many who also watch TYT who know of Audra Sparks, but she has been helping me with that. I have people behind this who are willing to help and get this because we are going to counter the conservative narrative with our nonprofit. That's what we're doing. We're going to be the free speech TV of the radio. And this is one of the ways that I found that we could all communicate and show solidarity. And I wanted to give something back to you since you've given so much to me.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you very much, Thomas. I really do appreciate it. I'm a lot more worried about your valve.
About what?
Your valve.
My valve will be fine. I was supposed to be dead on day one, and I had a doctor who was smart enough to give me a drug that Dr. Shah saw that I was turning blue, was smart enough not to give me oxygen, and gave me a drug that had just won a Pulitzer Prize, and saved my life. So I'm pretty sure that I will be fine. And plus I have Jules as treasurer of the network, and I have Steven as president. I'm only vice president, so it will continue even if I don't, because this has been my dream as a right winger. I'm doing it on the right side as a lefty. So anything I can do to help you stay on the air and keep doing what you love to do and keep you on our airwaves, I'm going to do. And I figured this was one of the things that I could do.
Well, it's really some interesting thinking. I mean, that's pretty well out of the box as far as I can tell, because I use a Gmail address, but of course, I never do it without thinking that in many ways it is more fragile than just, you know, having an email server on our regular domain name. We've had trouble making that work in the past. Oh, well, that's why I don't use it. But
sure.
And I just sort of countered my own argument. But my email is not my own.
Sure. This would essentially,
and it's got so goddamn many emails in it that if I don't pay Google $5 a month or $2.50 or whatever the hell it is, it all goes away.
Yeah, see, that's the thing with us. We're going to be scalable, and because we're communal and we're keeping it small to the radio audience and the listening audience, we're not trying to be Google.
No.
So the 1776 covers the expenses. We don't need to do ads. We don't need to do anything else. And anybody else who further donates to us helps cover those expenses. And in fact, a donor Sue, twin mom Sue, is in our chat all the time. By the way, Hillary supporter, not telling you how to vote.
Stop telling people how to vote.
But she will. And you don't want to hear what she has to say about Jill Stein. Ooh. Any gay.
Nice. I caught that. I heard what you did there.
You're welcome. She is the one who helped pay for the finalization of the software for us. And this is done by a professional company. It's on the up and up. They've been around for a while. I'm going to get the support, and I know PHP, so if there's, you know, a problem, it can be dealt with. And I wanted a way. I this is why I contacted you today. I wanted a way because I hear you and I hear your voice, and I know you hate doing what I do when it comes to talking about how much money you got to raise every day, you know. And we are a community, and the only way we can survive is if we help each other. And I'm a socialist. So I see no problem. Anyone who emails me and says, I got a subscription from the Patreon account over at the Patreon / FYI Nation account, I want some to go to Bob, I'll send $10 to Bob.
So how do they do it?
Okay, real simple. Right now it's pre-order. Nothing is set up yet. It should be either the 19th or the 31st. But all they have to do is go to Patreon and sign up through Patreon. Or email me at doubting.
Spell that. Spell that, please.
Sure. Doubting, like D-O-U-B-T-I-N-G, Tom, T-O-M, all one word, at FYINation.com. And just email me or go to the Patreon. Patreon is patreon.com/FYINation. You'll even see a little ad that Tom Hartman made for us, by the way, about other goodies that we have other than the email. But the email one is the part for you. And if you want to verify, it doesn't say anything about it on the Patreon for you. This is a reveal today that I'm doing right now. If you want to email me and ask me about it, I'll more than happily ask anyone's questions. It's a great supplement for Gmail. It's going to be exactly almost like Gmail as you can get. So I encourage everyone who thinks highly of you or Progressive Radio to maybe think about this, even if you already have one. You know, don't be one of those people who, you know, I just got to have one email account. You can never have. It's like a potato chip. You got to have more than one. All those MoveOn emails got to go somewhere. All those Jill Stein emails got to go somewhere. And do they really need to flood your family inbox?
Well, that's true, too.
See what I did there, Bob? So, but the main reason is, like I said, I've been trying. We also have the, you know, I want to try and help you as best I can. And until I'm rich and powerful, or my friend who's helping me write my book and we get it published, I can't do that. So there is this. And like I said, anybody who lets me know that they signed up because of this, I will send $10 through PayPal your way.
Sounds good. Thank you, Thomas. Okay. Thank you very kindly, and I hope it goes very, very well.
Well, thank you. And by the way, Bob, like I said, this is indefinite. As long as you're on the air, we're going to help you out because you're an affiliate of ours, and you let us kindly play your show when my software cooperates.
And, you know, when you're not preempting me.
Well, that, yeah, I'm an asshole. It was Donald Trump, though, for a little while. Mr. Cheeto, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And I get to make fun, so it was that.
But haven't all kidding aside, haven't we had enough?
Yeah. Oh, totally. All the rest of the we decided that all the rest of the debates, what we're going to do is we're still going to cover them. We're not going to preempt anymore. But what we're going to do is we're going to have one person in our group that's covering them watch the debate. I'm going to have it on my DVR because I have a DVR hooked up into the system. And when they say something happened, we're going to go to that something that happened and then commentate on it as it happened, as opposed to watching the whole thing and doing it. As fun as the Mystery Science Theater 3000 thing was once Jim Webb got killed, like he killed a guy, it didn't seem so much fun anymore. Just saying. Metaphorically speaking, of course. I want Jim to live longer than the guy he killed.
True enough. Speaking of guys and guys they killed and shot and whatever,
yes.
You did notice a couple of weeks ago that John Hinckley is out, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
Did you get around to mentioning that somebody needs to whisper in his ear that Donald Trump has the hots for Jodie Foster?
I did see a billboard about that, and I actually went off about that because I'm not the biggest fan of revenge stuff like that, but I can totally understand the humor because we talked about a bar in Vegas when I lived in Vegas that because it was a bar that did that, like some kind of sign like that, and the bar that I went by, I took the bus from work, and the bar every week changed their sign to something hysterical. I mean, whoever changed it was a comic genius. And it was on Eastern Avenue. I can't remember the name of the bar, but you drove by this bar sign, and it was something hysterical every week. I'm surprised some of it hasn't gone viral yet. I mean, we're talking beyond Pastor Manning, long-legged Mac Daddy hysterical there too, Bob.
Oh, you know? Yeah. And that is, of course, the platinum standard.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. It is.
We haven't heard from him in a while, have we?
Yeah, he's dealing with a lot. He's struggling, and I don't feel bad.
I hope it doesn't hurt too little.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, well, Thomas, it's good talking to you, my friend. You take care.
Definitely. You too, sir.
Bye now.
Bye.
The one and only Thomas, Doubting Thomas, Doubting Tom from FYI Nation BillableRick.com. And let's keep it rolling. Could it be Billable Rick?
Yes. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Good. You?
I'm doing okay. I figured I'd take a quick break from my brief that never is ending here. It was up to like 18,000 words until I got the client to drop an issue, so now it's only 17,000 or so, or 16,500, so. Yeah, so, yeah, I had fun with Tracy. Yeah, gave me a nice breakout.
It sounds like it was a blast. Hell, just being out with you two would probably be entertainment enough.
Yeah, well, maybe. I guess it's a matter of opinion, right?
Sure.
But, yeah, I laughed a lot. I think I laughed more than Tracy did. In fact, I probably laughed so much at times that my throat was kind of sore at the end of the night. You know, one of those?
Yeah.
So, oh, they were great. They did a whole riff on the Confederate flag as well, and how, you know, a couple of things here. First, I'll talk about the, you know, they really take their football seriously. And
the Rednecks?
Yeah. One of the guys kept, I forget who it was, but one of the guys, wasn't Trey. Well, it kind of was Trey. They were teasing one of the other guys who's a Georgian about how Tennessee had.
Oh, no, they had to be beside themselves.
Oh, they were.
Because Tennessee kind of owns the Eastern Conference, the Eastern Division of the SEC now.
Yeah, right, exactly. And they were talking about how things have kind of changed among, like, rednecks, so that, if one of your, you know, he was saying, look, if one of my kids came to me and said, you know, wanted to come out of the closet, you know, that'd be okay. But God forbid that they should say that they're an Alabama fan, you know, instead of a Tennessee fan or something like that, you know, then that's like, there's no negotiation about that point. That was kind of cute.
Asshole!
Yeah, exactly. And they were also talking about how rednecks do not appreciate the idea of irony. And so, like, in the South, you'll see these rednecks driving around with, actually, he said he saw, like, a Confederate flag, okay, the devil's diaper, you know, a big Confederate flag, and in the center was, like, a skull, like a picture of a skull, and then the skull was like wearing like an American flag, like a U.S. flag. And so, you know, it's kind of like these two things cannot exist at the same time, you know? You know, it's like, you know, either you're for the Confederacy or for the United States, you know, but these rednecks obviously, you know, don't appreciate that. And another point he made is that, you know, I mean, why the hell do people celebrate the Confederacy? You guys lost. Give it up. I mean, this is like the only time somebody's going to celebrate, and they do reenactments of battles and stuff. And, you know, he said that there was I think the bloodiest battle in the entire Civil War was, I think, in northern Georgia. I forget what city it was. And he says that all the rednecks, you know, in the area, like, do reenactments of the Civil War battle. And I think he asked somebody one time why they do the reenactments if the Confederacy lost. And they say something like, well, we won the battle but lost the war. You know? So.
There's a lot of that. It's that Shelby Foote stuff that Todd and I were talking about, you know, the last moments before Pickett's charge begins and the whole thing begins to unravel. Of course, it was all unraveling from the minute that Pierre-Gustave Tuton Beauregard decided he would take some key debts from the Citadel and fire pot shots at a federal installation in Charleston Harbor. And there were some people, Rick, who tried to explain that to the numbnuts, but as you may have learned Saturday night, there's some shit you cannot explain to numbnuts.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they have they don't know what the word irony means. You know, they're like, I guess, you know, they're they basically give off the scent of irony if it had a scent, you know?
Yeah.
You know, they just don't get it. They were great
guys.
You just got
a couple of notes from Brother Deacon Gerald of the Cathedral of Common Sense Building and Grounds Committee. He said,
good.
Doesn't Rick know it's heritage, not hate? The Confederacy lost. Thanks, Obama.
Well, we can definitely blame that on our first black president, even though he was the president, 180 years after the fact? Whatever.
Thereabouts.
Yeah. I mean, who's counting, right? Yeah, blame Obama.
Let's see, did your Hawkeyes survive this weekend?
No, they got beat by one of my other alma maters,
Northwestern. Yeah, okay, mm-hmm. Yeah,
I saw it coming.
Well, my Mountaineers almost snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, but you know, once again.
Yeah, they got a 1-point win.
Yeah, at the very, very end, yeah.
They're undefeated, right?
And that was the only team they had not beaten in Big 12 play at all.
Oh, K-State, huh? Wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, good. Well, congratulations. They're undefeated, and they'll probably be ranked this week if they're not already.
I haven't looked. I you would think, but then again, I would just assume they weren't. And, hey, we've got a bye week next week.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah, so these guys were... they were all very, very nice guys, easy to talk to and down to earth. And, Trey remembered you. And I suggested that maybe if they're like in the area, you all could meet up at the Secret Sandwich Society and they could put on like you could do a live broadcast. Although I don't know if you've mastered that technical.
We've done live from Secret Sandwich, but.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and I forgot the city that's in Fayetteville, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Probably a little too small for that tour, but.
Oh, is it okay?
But
yeah.
You know what? It would probably go over great. They could probably squeeze 50, 60 people into the Grove.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they could probably swing it. Yeah. It could probably be done. I imagine you could probably put more people in. I imagine just. Pack them in a little more.
How much were the tickets?
$25 each.
And a two-drink minimum.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Tracy had bought two tickets already, so I just reimbursed her for a ticket, and, I just put the bar tab on me. I figure, hey, what the heck? I think she paid for the Prince concert, the Prince movie, actually, now that I think about it. But who's counting? So... Yeah, it was a good time. We enjoyed it, and she got an advanced copy of the only copy of the book they have. It's not out. It's not due out till tomorrow, and got them all to after the manager or whatever said, hey, we have one copy here. You could have this if you want. You could buy this if you want. And then I told Tracy, hey, be sure to get them to sign it. So they each did a. They each signed it and, I'm sure addressed a note to her. I didn't actually see it, but she probably posted it on her Facebook by now, I think. And we also got a good picture of the five of us, the three comics, and then me and Tracy were amongst them. So, it was fun. I enjoyed it. I hadn't gone to I'd been to a comedy show there at the Ice House in Pasadena maybe 4 years earlier, but I hadn't, been there, I think, and that was my first and only time there. And they've had great comics there. Like Letterman has been there. I think Johnny Carson might have been there at some point in time, like way, way back. I mean, they've been around for like 60 years, and it's rated as one of the top five comedy clubs in the country. Which I guess explains why they've got a hopscotch from like L.A. to San Diego, then to New York, and then I think to Atlanta or something or Texas. And then back to New York and, stuff like that because, it's kind of a, it's the sort of thing you need a big, usually a fairly large town to support, a comedy store. They said that, where they grew up, I think there's a comedy store or comedy club in maybe Chattanooga. and then the nearest one from there is like 150 miles away. So, you know, there's just not a lot going on there in those, you know, smaller communities. They can't really support, you know, a comedy club or whatever. So anyway, that is my review. They were wonderful, and maybe Tracy will let me borrow her book once she's read it.
That'll be fun. That would be very cool.
And I will return it to her. I will not steal the book from her.
Yeah, that was not steal this book.
No. So, yeah, I guess that's about all I have to say, unless you got anything to add, Bob.
Well, I'm glad to hear from you. We've got a report from both sides of the not a date.
Oh,
because it wasn't. So that, you know, that works out very nicely, and both you and Tracy talking up the horn. God, that's just so cool.
We definitely, you know, that's how we found out about Trey, and I'm trying to remember how I found out about you. I think I found out about you from Malloy.
Yeah, most likely.
And I started listening. I said, oh, this guy's pretty good.
Yeah, which reminds me, I'll be filling in for Malloy Thursday night.
Oh, okay. Well, great.
Yeah.
And I guess my Moran Monday nomination have to be for the T-Rump. I don't know what comment for. I mean, pick your target there. Maybe the fact that Hillary might not have been loyal to Bill.
And could you blame her? Jesus.
I really couldn't.
What a schmuck. I mean, no. I mean, that's what he said. And, you know, I don't think she
could you blame her?
Yeah. I don't think she's been loyal to Bill, if you ask me. And could you blame her?
Yeah, right. And as Cole Morans, I would also put Newt and Giuliani in there as members of the Three Wives Club, co-members of the Three Wives Club, talking about how, you know.
Who answered the question about his philandering by saying, well, who hasn't fooled around?
Oh, jeez.
But the best part of it all, for anybody who wants to go and find it, and I have Chris in Germany to thank for this, the cold opening to Saturday Night Live was the debate.
Oh, that was good. Yeah, I saw part of
it. It was very good.
Yeah, I'll have to watch that on YouTube.
What am I thinking? Yeah, I'm thinking I'm going to be president.
What's that?
I can't remember the woman who plays Hillary.
she's a dead ringer. She's great.
Your thoughts, Mrs. Clinton? I'm thinking I'm going to be president.
And then another thing she said is, I have one request. let's just have the election now, or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, that may be better than Tina Fey's I Can See Russia from My House.
Yeah, I don't know.
And the moment was when Alec Baldwin did the thing with his mouth and made it look like an asshole. Because I've been wondering when somebody would point that out.
Oh, jeez.
Donald Trump's mouth looks like a dog's hind end when the dog really needs to get out the damn door. You know, the tail's up and curved,
geez.
And things are a little poochy there, and that's Trump's mouth.
I hope people aren't eating right now, Bob.
It wouldn't be the first meal I've ruined.
They should have eaten earlier. That's their problem. That's their fault. They shouldn't be in at 8:30 your time. Should have had the dinner by now.
But hey, it's 5:30 out there. I'm probably ruining the really good meals on the Pacific on the Pacific Coast.
And I'm the Rocky Mountain states as well. Oh, well.
Well, Rick, have yourself a good evening. Good luck with the brief.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. You take care, all right? Good work.
I'll try. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Our buddy Billable Rick calling from somewhere also in the wilds of Los Angeles. And, hey, fundraising update toward Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. This is a very, very good thing. We are, thanks to Kelly and... not sure if that's supposed to be anonymous or not. And thanks to Jenny, we've only got $55 to go. $55 to go in Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge to get the horn off to a rocking and rolling good start. So we've got a fighting chance here. Note coming in from Jan in Australia, late to the table this morning, but Rick, my nomination for Moran Monday is the Chicago Tribune. Gary the tongue-wagging fool Johnson? Really? Oi! See, this pile of rubble on which a woman shields two little bloodied children? That's fucking Aleppo, you goddamned walking, barely talking, incoherent, subfunctional defense of not legalizing pot freak. Never mind. Do we really think at this point endorsements will reach swing rage voters? Swing state rage voters? And that's the thing. I was just... Brother Deacon, Gerald, just pointed out to me that he was down in the southern reaches of West Virginia, and he said, the Trump is strong with these. He said, I swear if I think, let me get this right. Because I hate to blow a good line. I think if he dropped by and walked or attempted to walk on water, they'd proclaim the return of Jesus Christ himself. And, you know, with some of the sludge ponds down in, sludge seas, you know, melting billions of gallons and everything of toxic coal waste, with some of those things, he probably could walk on it. Ugh. Ugh. I said, in the South, you see these rednecks driving around. Gerald responds, do tell, never seen that before around here. Ah! Heritage, not hate. Yeah. And meanwhile, Gerald, you'll be glad to know that Jennifer has just awarded you a cowbell for the drumpf is strong with these. Let's run on back over to the Skype line. And check in with Jules relative to the previous conversation with a journalist extraordinaire and friend of the Horn community, John Roby. Hey, Jules.
Hey there, Bob. I found your conversation with the journalist extraordinaire. Absolutely wonderful. Very, very interesting. I had a very interesting experience, actually, I thought I would share with the community at large. He spoke about how people will turn to some of these street drugs as a way of comfort, a way of getting past the ways of getting relief from pain when they are turned away from these pain clinics or when they are lost from getting pain medications legally. And that is very true. And I've done a lot of work with people since in my second life, so to speak, since I had a series of strokes and I had to stop working and I've been disabled for a while now. But that's not why I was disabled, but it was my body kind of had some problems. But I'm a chronic pain patient also. And here a few weeks ago, my brother was found on the floor in the bathroom, and he had to be rushed to the hospital. He had overdosed on heroin. And he is one of those people who had sought out street drugs because he couldn't find relief through traditional method, through going through the pain clinic, or pain doctors, because he couldn't follow through with the pain regimen that was being prescribed for him. He just didn't have the gumption for it. He didn't have the attitude for it. And no one was willing to work with him. And
well, that statement I learned from the trial lawyer is very true. You know, pain is a picture window into hell.
Yes, it is. Exactly. And that's a huge problem because doctors aren't able to work with their patients to find out what is going to work for their patients. No one knows what it's like to be inside of another person's body. I don't know how many times I've had people say to me, I hate saying anything to you because I know you have to look so much worse because of what what my particular conditions are. And I'm like, honey, you know what? Your pain is as real to you as mine is to me. And as a matter of fact, yours probably hurts worse. And I say that to people because I realize that theirs probably does hurt worse because they don't deal with it in the same manner I deal with mine. I deal with mine as though it's not there. You know, I don't think about it. I don't care about it. It doesn't affect me the same way it does other people. I don't care about it, you know? So I just leave it.
Well, worth remembering that there is a difference between chronic and acute too.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem with all of this, Jules, is that we say pain as if there is one kind.
Yeah, exactly. And there isn't. That's exactly it. There isn't. There are so many types. And that's why I look at it as in someone else's to me is so much worse. Because theirs is probably something they've never experienced before. And mine, I've lived with all of my life. And for someone that's never experienced with it before, it's the worst thing in the fucking world. And what you said about the picture window is very true.
I don't make a whole lot of noise about it, but I went from about March to mid-August, Jules,
mm-hmm.
doing this program 5 nights a week,
mm-hmm.
and there was not a night of it when I was not in literally gut-bending pain, because
mm-hmm.
I could feel, it was like I could feel my guts bending,
mm-hmm.
and there's no relief for that.
No,
because the other side of the opioid coin is that because we're so, and I've remarked on this a dozen times, in places like Appalachia, if you've got real pain, you try not to ask for help because you're scared to death of being labeled a junkie. All right? And even if and as often as not, if you do ask for help, you won't get any relief because there has been a medical determination made that you're better off having constant life-altering pain than you are having relief for it and potentially becoming addicted.
Yeah, and it's because doctors are not trained properly in the use of pain medication.
No. Well, I disagree with you. I disagree with you, Jules. On that, I disagree with you. Because
there are other things besides narcotics, though, that can be used to help relieve pain. And narcotics don't necessarily work on stomach types of pain.
Yes. Well, they do in my case.
In certain situations.
They do in my case because the first time I had one of these experiences. I was basically medicated out of my mind for 2 weeks and
mm-hmm.
lived on nothing but water
mm-hmm.
and was able to pretty much nod through it, frankly.
So it does
work, but the problem is there is, because there are so many stories, because there are so many legends, urban myths, well, rural myths, whatever you want to call them, And because there are so many real abusers of these things, for a variety of reasons that often begin with the right reasons and end up being something otherwise, hillbillies with real pain have real problems getting relief for it in places where opiates and opioids are specifically useful. Okay?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I 4 ibuprofens are not going to touch my problem.
No, and probably they're going to make it worse.
They will make it worse because of their impact on the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, opioids can bind up your bowel motility. Absolutely.
But if you can't eat
in the first place, well, you see the problem.
Yes, but there are also things to help with motility too. I mean, there are always things that can be done. It depends, but what I was going to say, it depends on what the receptors are and what exactly is going on. You know, if it's a muscular problem that's causing the pain, then yeah, opioids may very well be something that will help relieve it. You know, it just is really, really determinant on what the problem is. And doctors are not prescribing these medications the way they should be prescribing them. And this goes back to, I mean, not very many years ago when you go to the ER and a doctor would hand out a prescription for, you know, 150 Vicodin, and a person would go from one ER to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, and they'd end up with, you know, 800 Vicodin in one night, and they'd go out and sell it on the street. And this is where we ended up with this fucking problem with these opiates. You know?
Well, that's what I was talking about when I talked about the hydrocodone carpool.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, I had an answer, and this is a good place to share it. I had an answer from Andy in the Netherlands in regard to painkillers in the EU. Andy writes, I can add that in the Netherlands, they're not big on prescribing painkillers at all. Even at the dentist, if you need some drilling done, they might ask you if you want some anesthetics with that or if you want to do it without. So no laughing gas either. I recently had an abscess tooth fixed, and I didn't get any painkillers whatsoever. I had to make do with some store-bought ibuprofen. It wasn't pleasant, but it worked out in the end. So in the end, I think Americans are an over-medicated people compared to Europeans.
Yeah. Maybe we just expect to not have to live with certain things, and I think pain is something we shouldn't have to live with in this day and age. But as I said, there are other things besides narcotics that can be used to help treat certain types of pain. There are muscle relaxers. There are certain types of things like Neurontin, gabapentin. There are different varieties of gabapentin. There are certain types of antidepressants that can help, both tricyclic SSRIs, SSNRIs. And it depends on what, you know, if it's like a fibromyalgia type of pain, if it's a, if it's a nerve type of pain, you know, it depends on what type of pain it is as to how it should be targeted. And you really need to see a doctor that is going to break down what it is. And most doctors aren't going to do that because they aren't being given enough time with their patients. And so they throw narcotics at them, and they aren't giving them the right tools, and they aren't giving them the right instructions, and it's causing a lot of problems. I mean, so you know, narcotics manufacturers are making these drugs; they're pushing them towards the doctors, push, push, push. The doctors are pushing them towards the patients. Patients aren't getting, you know, are taking them irresponsibly, and you know, whereas if they were being given correctly, then we wouldn't have this overabundance of narcotics being thrown at people. They would be given out in a very limited amount. So, I mean, that's just my opinion.
Well, and I don't think it's off the mark. I got a comment here. As a side note to the painkiller problem, I have family members that will badger the living hell out of you if they know you've had any kind of procedure, mostly dental work, that the doctor may have prescribed some to you. That also applies to coworkers. If they know you have them, you better keep them locked up or at home. And I know that to be an absolute truth, because I remember when the lady from across the street, Ferg had just had his tonsils out and his adenoids out. I've told this story before.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, all of a sudden, she pops up at the door. Well, I just came to see how Ferg is. Hey, can I use y'all's bathroom?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, without thinking anything about it, Ferg's liquid hydrocodone syrup for his post-tonsillectomy care we just stuck it in the medicine cabinet. He wasn't tall enough to reach it, so that was what mattered.
Yeah.
Well, it came time for Ferg's dose, Agnes went to the bathroom to get the bottle of hydrocodone syrup. Guess what?
None there.
Wasn't there. Step out on the porch and you can hear, ha ha, you know, and, you know, just a high old time across the road.
Mm-hmm.
Over there doing hydrocodone shooters.
And I've never had a sense of being stoned or high or anything from narcotics. I mean, I've never, ever in my life.
Oh, no, they knocked my ass right out. I mean, but then again, I'm super sensitive. I get sleepy walking past the Benadryl in the drugstore. But
most MS patients have a reversed reaction to a lot of medications.
Oh, my family is almost famous for idiosyncratic drug reactions. They would give my grandmother Ativan when she had moved into her final dementia.
Yeah.
And that shit would make her tap dance on a tin roof.
Mm-hmm.
When my dad was in hospice, they gave him a little dose of not Thorazine. What's the other stuff? Haldol. Made him absolutely wild.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
And we said, don't do that anymore. And they said, oh, we won't.
No, they didn't, did they? Yeah, paradoxal, like for me with anesthetic, I can't count the number of times I've woken up during surgeries.
I can't imagine.
With the aorostenosis, it's a condition where your joints dislocate spontaneously. So with the rheumatoid arthritis, you can imagine how interesting that can get. So, and it's just, it's one of those things where, you know, you just have paradoxical effects. And so sleeping pills keep me awake. So I don't sleep a lot. And there's nothing that really challenges to help, you know, with that problem. And you just have.
That's why you listen to this program. It helps you nod off.
Oh, no, actually, I love this program. I absolutely love it.
No,
I love the people in the chat room, and I love the people, you know, I love listening to the people that write in and the people that talk, and, you know, and that's why everyone needs to, you know, if everyone could give, you know, like a couple bucks a month, just sign up on a membership, and, you know, $5 a month or, you know, a couple bucks a month, anything, you know, those memberships are great because it's monthly income and you know it's going to be there, and every little bit helps, you know. So,
well, it does, and we've only got $55 to go on Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, and that's a really big deal, finishing that off and getting that extra $200. I mean, it's
And but you know, if you had memberships, if you had everyone that did memberships, then you wouldn't have to do
No, no, no. If we had 400 $10 a month subscribers, I would never have to mention this again.
Yep. See, there you go.
And, you know, we're still working on it, and the offer's still out there. $10 subscribers get a bumper sticker. And I just sent a...
Which I just got today.
Oh, you got yours?
Yes, I just got mine today.
I know Dwayne in Pennsylvania got his, and I got a note from Randy saying he got his. And there's a boodle of them out there going out. So.
I wanted to say thank you. Thank you very much. That was another reason I wanted to call in, is to say thank you very much. I just received one today.
Lovely. Well, Jules, we got to roll because it's that time.
Yes, it is that time. It sure is.
All right. Take care, Jules. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you very much. You have a very great evening. And everyone, please help Bob out here. Thank you very much, folks. Have
Bye.
A good night.
Yeah, that offer's on the table. A $10 monthly subscription gets you a bumper sticker. Courtesy of our buddy Scott, and we're still still taking orders on the second round of the wild rice offer. If you want to participate, so that's where we end it this evening. Thanks very kindly to Dr. John Roby for all of his kind input. I really do appreciate it. Like I said, it was a story that needed far more detail than just ranting about something for 20 minutes can do. Or 5 or 10. Thank you, Dr. John. And thank you to everyone who makes all of this happen. Thank you to our subscribers. Thank you very kindly. Thanks very much to Kelly and Anonymous, Until I Hear Otherwise, and Jenny for getting us as close to the challenge as we've gotten. $55 more, and the challenge is met, and the money gets doubled. So hopefully that'll happen overnight. Y'all have a wonderful evening. Catch you for Titanic Tuesday tomorrow. All right. Good night, y'all. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.